sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to talk about the TPP, not the stuff that's in the bathroom, though. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Yes, they have thrown that out there for fast track, which means they're going to give the president the authority to say, yeah, we'll take it as it is. Give us that trade bill that only 600 quote-unquote trade advisors have been able to see. You didn't get to see it. I didn't get to see it. And, you know, what's frustrating to me is this guy said he was going to be the most transparent president in history. I'm beyond infuriated over this. Also going to talk about the West Virginia spill. Evidently, the water's good now. Go back. The toxic sludge is within acceptable levels. Because, you know, it's good to have a little toxic sludge in your system. Helps out with the Cosperatus. Also going to talk about the war on the poor. And, you know, are we seeing the beginning of the end of GOP world? And if we are, sadly, it means the end for so many hardworking people in this state and in this country. Sad, sad stuff. Going to take your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. So today it began. Yes. Our General Assembly back in session. The House is back. They'll be at work a couple of days this week. I think they have next week off. And they'll be back a couple of days at the end of the month to cause some more mischief. What we are seeing, and this is one of the really very interesting, to step back and watch it as a political observer, as an outsider watching the money being spread around, the chess pieces being put into place. This really, what we're seeing before us, is the purification of the Republican Party here in Pennsylvania. We've seen this happen in other states. It happened in Michigan, happened in Wisconsin. This is now where the Koch brothers are coming in saying, okay, we've got the pot of gold, and we're giving you the path for you to get your pot of gold. Now, understand, for you to get your pot of gold, state legislator, well, you're going to have to turn your back on all of those people in your state. And the question then becomes, what are we going to see in the next couple of weeks? What are we going to see in the next couple of months? Right now, they're pushing a whole lot of venomous poison. There's a lot of this stuff bing-banging around, looking for support. It's been told to me, and this is one of those moments where you go, wow. It's been told to me that a Republican legislator is telling people that the Koch brothers were in town sometime around Christmas. And the Koch brothers told a number of Republican lawmakers that if they pass this paycheck destruction bill, if they pass this anti-dues checkoff bill, if they begin the process towards making Pennsylvania a no-rights-at-work state, if they do this, there'll be lots of money. And they said, look, this is how it's been explained to me, that the Koch brothers told these legislators, and I've got to think that they've also gone to a number of Democrats that they've identified as potentially swayable, saying, look, we know that, you know, you get money from these different organizations, be it labor unions or progressive groups, or we know you get a little bit of money from them. Whatever they give you will double. Going to double down. Now, think about this in the context of the Manufacturing Association already outspends labor 11 to 1. The Chamber of Commerce spends labor multiples to 1. Working people are already horribly outspent, which is why what we have in this country is one-party media rule. We hear one side of the message. Rarely do you hear an honest debate. Rarely do you hear both sides of any story, which is why I love doing this program. I love doing this program because it's rare that I do an event or I go to a function and someone says to me, we need less programs like yours. I keep hearing people say, we need more. We need more honest thought because you know what? And this just happened to me the day before yesterday. A guy goes, you know, I don't agree with you. Because that's how they always starts off, being in this area. I don't agree with you, but you've made me think about this differently. you've made me think about this a little bit in a new way. There's nothing more exciting for me than that. The fact that what we talk about on this program gets people to stop and say, well, wait a second. That's not what we've been told. It's like free trade, and it was in the context of free trade, which is why we're going to talk a little bit more about it. They'd always thought, hey, free trade's great for everyone. Raises all boats. Because in theory, when you learned about it in the textbook, when it was on the piece of paper, worked wonderfully. Problem is, the neoliberal trade policies that we've been following for the last 30 years, we've basically been shedding jobs at an alarming rate so that corporate America can profit. So when this person who admitted to me he's never voted for a Democrat in his life started to said, I'm thinking about these things a little bit differently. What more can you ask for? Now, you're not going to turn him into some fancy pants liberal. It's not going to happen. But as long as we can start thinking and coming to some rational, sane, when Dwight David Eisenhower looks like a socialist, and I joke about that often, there's something wrong with our politic today. But what we're seeing here in Pennsylvania is this purification. And the moneyed interest, this is not from inside the state. This is all coming from outside of the Commonwealth. It's coming from Wall Street. It's coming from the Koch brothers. It's coming from the Diane Hendricks of the world. It's coming from the wealth class of this country saying, hey, we've now got this huge pile of cash. We've got this pile of cash. Do what we tell you. And do it now. So right now, as the priorities you're going to see coming out of the General Assembly right now is the purification process. And you go, well, what do you mean by that, Rick? What I mean is they're hurrying this up. They're pushing this timetable up as fast as possible because they want to get to the primary deadlines. If there's a Republican who doesn't sign on and doesn't say, we want to screw these working people, and we want to stick it to those unions, those evil unions who support workers, they're going to know who they are. And then they're going to primary them with huge money. And look, there's a lot of Republicans who look at the process and go, man, things are screwed up. But I got to worry about my right flank. Never mind the left. I got to worry about the insanity of the extreme right and the huge money that can come in at any time and throw a million, two, five, 10 million into a house race and wipe out an incumbent. So what we're seeing before us is this Republican purification. And you had better follow the corporate line. They had better follow the ALEC dictates. You know, when we were in Wisconsin, just about 3 years ago now, I remember saying, we're here because it's coming our way. And it wasn't because I was clairvoyant. I didn't look into a crystal ball. It doesn't take a genius to figure it out. When the huge money interests, when the billionaires say we want something, they're going to get it. And they started in Wisconsin because they had an insane Republican governor and a Republican legislature. They went to Indiana, had a Republican governor, a Republican legislature. They went to Michigan, had a Republican governor, a Republican legislature. And you didn't have to go far. Went to Ohio, Republican governor, Republican legislature. You didn't have to figure it out. You just had to look at a map and go, the arrow is pointing our direction. Well, you know, like in any game of spin the bottle, it's our turn. And they're coming after us. Wallets open, checkbooks ready, propaganda prepared. Infrastructure built, and in the next weeks and months, we are going to hear a barrage of anti-worker, anti-union messaging that I don't think this state has ever seen. You know, you talk to people in Wisconsin, and I remember when the recall election was going on, which I wasn't all that thrilled with. I thought there should have been something else. But I remember during that, and when it went the wrong way, someone told me that their theory, and I agreed with it, that their theory was that people just wanted the messaging to stop. They wanted the pain to stop, and they were willing to give up whatever it was to make it stop. It's kind of like waterboarding. What happened in Wisconsin, kind of like waterboarding. You put people in enough discomfort, you barrage them enough, and eventually they just say, please stop, whatever. I think we're going to see that kind of media campaign, that kind of push, if the Republicans think, if the moneyed interests think there's enough Republicans to push this over the edge, if they can pressure enough. And this is where I go back to my sane, rational Republican friends, of which I have a number of. When we look at this, you got to look at the argument on its face. The argument that the ALEC people are giving, the Koch brothers are giving, is that, you know, it's just too expensive for the state to collect dues for the unions. And this is what it boils down to. I don't know that it gets much simpler in their argument than this. And the response is even simpler than that. It's too expensive for us to take the dues and give them up. Something that was negotiated between the state and the workers. Just too expensive. But we have 150 other things that we do that for. It's not too expensive for them. Think that one through for a second. If it were that all that expensive, I do believe that something else you could have negotiated so that you could have gotten some compensation for it. But that's not the point. The point is this is punishment. It's direct punishment for workers not falling into line. And, you know, I've told the story of my grandfather a number of times when he took my grandmother out to dinner and to a play and sat there next to the boss. The boss don't want you around. That's what this is. This is not only purification of the Republican Party, it's making that line in the sand that there are working people and there are really, really rich people. And that's it. So over the next couple of weeks and months, this is going to be one of the issues that I think we need to be talking about and we need to be telling our friends about and calling our legislators about. And I'm going to have a number of people come on the program and talk about it, the importance of the education process that goes into this. The messaging from the right is going to be slick, masterful, and BS. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Filmon, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, one of the unions directly affected by this poison. Quick break. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan is launching a new campaign today at the Detroit Auto Show called Labor Rights Are Civil Rights. Nissan workers are joining clergy, the Mississippi NAACP, elected officials, civil rights activists, and students to launch this new campaign aimed at making people aware of the struggle to organize the Canton, Mississippi auto plant. Workers there are attempting to join the United Auto Workers as they push Nissan to agree to a fair union election free of intimidation and threats from the employer. Even as Mississippi workers launch their labor rights or civil rights campaign in Detroit, North Carolina's Moral Monday movement is spreading through the South. After drawing thousands of protesters and inspiring the arrests of more than 900 people in civil disobedience protest actions, Georgia will see its first Moral Monday at the state capitol there. The Georgia NAACP is leading that protest, but the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement will be at the Georgia protest today. In South Carolina, progressive protesters will greet the state's legislature as it convenes Tuesday for a Moral Monday-style protest billed as Truthful Tuesday. These protests challenge the extreme right-wing agendas of Republican-dominated state governments in the South. The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO has a message for U.S. Congressman Ron Kind. Knock off the support for trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they are no good for workers or for farmers. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
We have no evidence, and he's presented none, nor has anyone else, that any of these trade agreements do any good for the workers. U.S. dairy farmers are going to lose over $20 billion in 10 years. I think everyone knows Wisconsin's a pretty big dairy state.
The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO Central Labor Council has sent Congressman Ron Kind a copy of Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's book, Myths of Free Trade, Why American Trade Policy Has Failed, in an effort to enlighten the congressman about trade policy. Global labor organizations are protesting the gunning down of striking Cambodian garment workers January 3rd. The workers were killed by Cambodian military using AK-47 assault rifles. The government has banned demonstrations and is using the military to control the streets. The violence ended the strike. Industrial, Uni Global Union, the International Trade Union Confederation, the Cambodia Labor Confederation, and Workers United are all demanding that the Cambodian government stop the violence, restore freedom of association and assembly, release the detained workers and drop any charges against them, and resume negotiations for an increase in the minimum wage. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Labor Federation is deeply disappointed in the U.S. State Department for allowing Indian consular officer Devyani Kobragadi to escape visa fraud charges through diplomatic immunity. The charges came after a domestic worker fled working conditions and approached human trafficking, according to Trumka. Trumka says the indictment against the Indian diplomat was a positive step in the movement to uphold the rights of domestic workers, and Trumka says the American labor movement will continue to stand by Sangeeta Richard and the domestic workers' family as they adjust to life in the U.S.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, we're bosses than you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem? How did folk become online? The governor says they're tightening their belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Well, when you became the problem was when the Koch brothers said so, when Wall Street said so, when the billionaire class said, you know what, they've got pensions, let's take them. There are rules that help them and not us. Let's end those. And that's what's going on here in the Commonwealth right now. You look at poll after poll. People want jobs, people want education, people want health care. They don't want liquor privatization, they don't want to privatize the lottery, they don't want to go after these no rights at work schemes, but yet, you know, the people who are in charge of our legislature, they've got their own set of priorities. And they're not yours and they're not mine. And that's what's infuriating. Anyway, here to talk about the this amending the Public Employees Relation Act from 1970, this House Bill 1507. I've asked David Feldman to come talk to us, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me on and spreading the word.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, you talk to people every day. They're worried about jobs. They're worried about health care. They're worried about their kids' education. Everything that I'm seeing coming out of Harrisburg is the antithesis of what people really want.
This is exactly it. House Bill 1507 does absolutely nothing to address any of the problems that we have in the state of Pennsylvania, starting with the jobs out there, you name it, immigration, anything that's there. This is a purely vindictive bill that is solely targeting public sector unions. For absolutely no reason whatsoever.
I'm told that collecting dues, for folks that don't know, what we're talking about is there are a number of legislators, basically with directive from the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the wealth class of this country, saying it's just too expensive for the state to collect dues from the workers so that the workers' union will have money. It's just way too expensive.
And it is exactly... in your prologue, you talked about Wisconsin and Michigan. It's the same pattern. It's coming, working its way down. They started with Wisconsin and did those kind of things. And you're absolutely right. There is no cost involved with this. This dues deduction, payroll deduction, has been in place since the very first governor. We have been having this in place. In fact, it was, if there was any cost involved, it would have been back in the early 70s, before the computer systems were so advanced. Now, the computer is just a line item on the payroll sheet, and it's all electronically transmitted. No problem whatsoever. In fact, our contracts even provide that if there's a cost involved, that we would bear that cost. And there has been no governor at all that has asked for any kind of reimbursement because there's nothing involved with this process. They are just trying to shut down the public sector unions so that they don't have a voice at the table, and it really works its way down to the working class, which is really what this corporate policy is. Let's just shut down the working class.
In your opinion, is this something, because, you know, we hear legislators, well, I'm just doing what my constituents want. Is this coming from Pennsylvania, or is, in my view, do you agree that this is coming from Wall Street, the Koch brothers, the Diane Hendricks of the world, the billionaire class that you and I and all the other workers in this country have created? Where's it coming from?
You're absolutely right. It's a national program. ALEC was the one that did it. They came up with the, and the ALEC creates these conservative policies. They distributed them to the legislatures who belong to ALEC. Some of them have bailed out, but we still have some in Pennsylvania that belong there or are still part of that organization. But really this thing, again, creates nothing of substance at all for the state of Pennsylvania. It's not going to create any more Commonwealth jobs. It's going to, you know, stop any layoffs from occurring. Nothing like that at all. In fact, I think you said it in the beginning, we have so many things that there are payroll deductions for right now in the state of Pennsylvania. We have the United Way, which labor, by the way, participates in what's called the State Employees Combined Appeal. They had a $3 million contribution piece this year. They did very, very well. We release our own members to help out with that, so we can help the folks that aren't as fortunate as us with the United Way contributions. You have the Pennsylvania State Employees Credit Union that has a payroll deduction on the pay systems. And just recently, with Governor Corbett, and it wasn't before him, he brought in supplemental insurance through a payroll deduction. So now you can buy Aflac or you can buy auto insurance, and it comes out of your paycheck if you want to have that happen.
So, and that's not too expensive?
That's not too expensive. You don't think those folks are lobbying also with the money that the members are paying into their coffers? So it's totally ironic. And we think actually it's going to be discriminatory or unconstitutional that they're singling out just our sector of organized labor and no one else is going to be suffering.
Well, judging the last 3 years, I don't think they care one bit whether it's constitutional or not. I mean, you look at the gerrymandering, you look at Act 13, you look at the voter suppression, you look at all of these things, constitutional, not unconstitutional, they don't seem to care.
But they, I think this time, and Rick, we are prepared to battle big time. We had a meeting today with the labor unions, and we had over 300 people on the phone that were conferenced in to listen to hear what was going on. We had, we're gearing up, reaching out to the representative, reaching out to the state senators to show them this is totally, totally uncalled for, and it's not going to create any kind of positive relationship in Pennsylvania when it comes to organized labor or just the working class here. And I think the other thing is, and you were right, there are some folks from the conservative side that are going to these reps and senators and saying, hey, we'll give you even more money than the unions do if you go ahead this way. Well, that's going to be, if that does occur, it's a one-shot deal. Let me tell you, if they pass this thing, we are going to be on them constantly from now, just like in Wisconsin. The labor organizations didn't just go away. They're in it for the long haul. And this thing is just going to get real ugly if it goes through as it is.
And the thing is this isn't the kind of politic I think most voters in Pennsylvania want, care for, or would even, I hope would even tolerate.
But the problem is, and the Commonwealth Foundation is out there right now with a YouTube video that's throwing out lies about how this process is going, talking about the cost involved, but there is no cost involved. It's a computer line item that happens at this point, moves it from one place to another. That's it. It's not someone working in a back room with a bookkeeper. It's no cost whatsoever involved, but they're going to lie about it. They're going to lie about the political contributions, which you know, Rick, We can't use union dues for political contributions. That's a whole separate entity that we have to go voluntarily to the members to do that. Yet you go to the Commonwealth Foundation, they know exactly how much money I make. They know exactly how much money we spend on lobbying. But you go to the Commonwealth and find out where their donors are. That's a big secret, because they don't have to tell you who those corporations and millionaires and CEOs behind them. They work in secret. We all work in the public.
Now, I've asked Matt Briett a number of times how much he makes, and he's never told me, and nor has he ever told me where the money comes from.
You'll never hear that, by the way.
Which is another one of those things. You brought up lobbying there, and just to highlight this, because I want to make sure that it's very clear. You brought up that Aflac and the other people that get dues, get checkoff money from the state, they're doing lobbying too. I wanted to highlight the fact that the dues that are collected, can you use dues money for political stuff? Because one of the arguments is that the state is collecting all of this money that is then being used against the taxpayer. And I just wanted to get your reaction.
No, it's against the law for us to do that. Labor unions from back in the 1930s have been handcuffed with a lot of laws that makes it very transparent what we do. We have to file with the federal government. We have to file with the labor boards how much we make, how much our dues are, what kind of lobbying activity we do. But we can't take the dues that are used for the servicing of contracts, the negotiating of contracts, and give that check over to state rep whoever. We have to use a whole separate system, again, another accounting system for us, where we have to make sure we keep track of all that money, where that money goes. There's limits in federal campaigns. We don't even have a federal PAC here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME. It comes out of our Washington office. But all of that money that goes contributing to the politicians that we need for working-class people, and that's all we want to do. We don't care if it's Democrat, Republican, Independent. As long as you treat the working-class folk okay, you're going to have our vote, and you're going to have our endorsement and the power that we can do to try to get you into that office. But all of that money has to be voluntary. Just because you're a union member doesn't mean you can have to give any money to us politically. That's a whole separate deal. So, yes, and that's a lie they're spinning out there, that your union dues are being used in political purposes. Absolutely false.
You know, I hear a lot of anecdotal things. And I wanted to try and throw some of these out. One person told me day before yesterday that they know someone, and I love every story that starts off with "I know someone," because it's usually BS. But I just wanted to get your reaction. He started off telling you that he knows somebody who works for the state, that they're not happy that they're forced to pay dues, and that those dues are used against them because they're pro-life, and that the unions are anti-abortion, and all this nonsense that he really couldn't quantify. But there is this view that this is forced, that they have to do it. I wanted to get your reaction.
No, there's a couple things. They don't have to be a member of the union. The only thing that we have provisions there in our contract is what's called a agency fee or a fair share fee. So we can't charge them the full dues piece, but we will charge them for the servicing, the grievance procedure, the negotiating their contracts, maintaining their benefits, whatever that may be. Keep an eye on their pension, which is at jeopardy at this point. Those are the kinds of things that we can keep an eye on, and we can charge those fees even if a person's 100% against this. We do encourage everybody to be a full member. They can run for office, and the same as me. Rick, I'm up for election every 3 years.
Yep.
If people don't like what I do, they can vote me out every 3 years, and someone else can do it. So we have to be accountable to the members because of that process, and I think we're on the up and up. We have to make these reports. We have to make it all above board. So we are complying by the law. This, again, is just vindictive to get rid of us so that the corporation can do whatever the hell they want to.
We've heard nice names thrown around, like paycheck protection or paycheck fairness. Does this do anything to make paychecks fairer, or does it do anything to protect someone's paycheck?
Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with that. And again, it gets back to the lies they're going to be putting out there, the spin, the talk, just like right-to-work legislation. It's really right to work for less, but it sounds nice. Everybody wants a right to work. So we are going to be up against those kinds of things. And you're right. There's going to be money coming in here, not from Pennsylvania. It's going to be coming out from wherever it is, and they're going to try to dump it in here so they can get another Wisconsin here. But let me tell you, from a meeting today with the leaders of all the organized labor in Pennsylvania. We're ready for the battle, and this is going to be a real big one if they take this on.
Let me ask you last line of questioning on this issue. You know, I've got a lot of friends that, you know, who email me back and forth because of the program, and they've asked a very simple question. This seems like a union issue. Why is this important to me? I'm never going to be a union member. I'm never going to have the fortune to be a union member. Why is it important to me?
Well, it's just what is taking over the working class. And we've seen recently where the CEOs, there's no problem with them making 500 times or whatever that number is of what their folks that they are having in their factories or whatever that may be. So once we, and I'm saying organized labor, if we get crushed, if we get taken down, you can believe that they're not going to bring the other non-union working folk up. They're going to keep them down even less than that, and the corporations will be able to do whatever the heck they want to do. This is exactly what their national game plan is, and we can't let it happen in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know. When we were, you know, just about 3 years ago now, we were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol in Wisconsin, sleeping on the cold marble floor because it wasn't as warm in Wisconsin as it is here right now. And I remember saying, as we broadcast from inside the Capitol, saying, get ready, it's coming our way, when we were in Ohio for the SB5 fight. I was saying, it's coming this way, get ready. Well, here it is.
And exactly, we're going to take those game plans, my counterpart in Wisconsin, my counterpart in Michigan, my counterpart in Ohio. We will find out what the messages were out there to see exactly what happens. But again, those guys are still in business, and I'm talking about the unions that are out there. Have they got cut off the legs? Yes, they have. But they're still there. They're going to be there as long as they possibly can, and they're going to be there forever as far as I'm concerned, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen here.
So now, because to me this seems like an awful waste of money, an awful waste of time and energy for everybody in the process except for the Wall Street folks and the Koch brothers who keep us all infighting so they can keep picking our pockets. I'm of the mindset, you know, when Corbett came into office, he said it was going to be about jobs and getting the state moving in the right direction. It's not. I hear people talking about health care and education, yet all they focused on was these liquor privatizations and the lottery privatization that has cost us, the taxpayer, millions and millions of dollars. To me, that's what we should be screaming about, and that's what I scream about every night because I'm tired of getting ripped off by these schemes.
Exactly, and then they're taking you away from that, the legislature in particular, the reps and the senators. There are more important things in Pennsylvania to be arguing, debating about, passing laws about. This is certainly not one of them. Again, it doesn't put Pennsylvania in a better light at all for anything to help the working class or anybody out there. This is purely vindictive, and if this is not the way the political process should work, just to go after people because they're looking out for the working class.
You know, as I said last week when I talked with Wendell Young, it's very Machiavellian. Taking your opponent out in public and goring them to send the message. And that's all this appears to me to be.
Exactly right. And, again, the national guys will come in. The ALEC will come in. If they get what they wanted, they're gone. They don't care what the damage is, the nuclear damage that comes from something like this. They'll just be out of here. They did their work. And it's for us now, the taxpayers and the working folk and the legislators, to try to get some semblance of order. And it's going to be damaged forever.
Yeah. Dave, you've got a friend here at the Rick Smith Show. Anytime, come back and talk to us. We want to make sure that we're up on top of this and we stay right there with it.
Keep up the fight, my friend.
Thanks so much, David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates destroyed the right-wing narrative that his memoir attacks President Obama's approach to the war in Afghanistan. Here he is on NBC's Today.
The book has sort of been hijacked by people along the political spectrum to serve their own purposes, taking quotes out of context and so on.
Following the release of excerpts from the memoir, The Washington Post's Bob Woodward characterized it as a damning critique of Obama that unleashes harsh judgments about his leadership in Afghanistan. Fox News quickly followed suit. On America's Newsroom, Fox military analyst retired General Jack Keane claimed Gates' memoir showed the following.
President Bush wanted to win, and President Obama simply put wanted to get out.
Despite Fox's attempt to hijack his memoir, Gates continues to praise Obama and reiterate, quote, what has been lost in the news media is that I actually agreed with virtually every decision President Obama made on Afghanistan. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Perhaps you thought the political world was finally safe from the dynamic duo of Ford and Raydell. But no, here they come, rushing back into the limelight. Rob Ford, the explosive mayor of Toronto, became a global punchline last fall when a video showed his honor smoking crack cocaine. Then came little blow-ups involving sexual harassment, a murder threat, knocking down a city councilwoman, and drunken rages. Yet, on January 2nd, Rob was back, filing for re-election and blurting out that, my record speaks for itself. Well, he's right about that. Even less charming is Trey Raydell, a first-term Congress critter from Fort Myers, Florida. His chief accomplishment in Washington was getting arrested last October for trying to buy cocaine from an undercover cop. But rather than humbly stepping down, or even quieting down, Trey called a December press conference to announce that he's healed. Having completed a 28-day treatment program for addiction, though apparently not for narcissism, the former TV anchorman declared himself fit to return to what I do, what you sent me to do in Washington. Presumably, that does not include scuttling around back alleys seeking drugs and drink. Raydell said that, thanks to God and family, he's a changed man. For one thing, while he still insists that poor families should be subjected to drug tests in order to get food stamps, he has slightly amended that Dickensian stance. I think members of Congress should be tested as well, he said with a straight face. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Raydell wants poor people's food stamps automatically taken away if they're caught using drugs. But a lawmaker who gets nabbed can keep drawing his $170,000 a year government salary. Still, that doesn't make Raydell a hypocrite, because, as Stephen Colbert points out, lawmakers don't get food stamps.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man.
You know, the thing that gets me, and going back to my conversation with Dave Filmon, is, you know, this costs nothing. And I was thinking about it during the break. Why would the people who tell us that they want smaller, less intrusive government want to put themselves in the middle of an employer-employee relationship where you sit down and you negotiate? Understand, this is really very simple, very basic stuff. When you sit down and you negotiate what your contract is going to be, one of the things you negotiate is the checkoff, saying, okay, well, we'll put it on our automatic our deduction system, and we'll forward you the money. It's just a line, computer line on a computer code on a line. Well, no problem. Just a bunch of transfers. And if there were costs, that's something you would negotiate. Now, understand, the other part of this is, like in any negotiation, this is where the Republicans really seem to... This is where, to me, it is very simply about Machiavellian politics. It's about crushing your enemies. All the consequences be damned. It's about gutting your enemy in public. What they're actually doing is they're taking away a negotiating position. If it were me, I would say, no. If I were the state, I'd say, don't. I need that. Because much like, you know, any other thing that's on the table, you can take it off in the bargaining process. You don't think the state has heavily leveraged that clause in their contract? I remember I worked for a place that actually had negotiated in their contract that everyone would be paid through electronic bank transfer. There would be no more paychecks. And the company said it saved us somewhere in the range of, it saved them, didn't save me anything. It saved the company about 50 cents per person per paycheck, not to have to write that check out, mail it, and all of that other stuff. They're just going to go through a bank transfer, which were, you know, hundredths of a penny per person. That was something that was negotiated. And this is what gets me. These are the people who tell me they believe in smaller government, yet every time I turn around, man, they're jabbing me in the back. And themselves, because this is just dumb from a policy standpoint. If you look at it from political payback, the very Chris Christie-type things, this is basically closing all the lanes to the George Washington Bridge. It's that simple. Because it's payback. You don't agree with us, we're going to crush you. And I go back and I think about this from a Democratic standpoint. This is one of the things Democrats don't generally do. They're not that vindictive. They're more of the good government types. We need to run things. We care about people getting health care and jobs. Not this scorched earth mentality. And I ask you, just from a logical, common sense point of view, I know virtually everybody I know has something deducted out of their paycheck, whether it's money that goes into a savings account, money that goes into a Christmas fund, money that goes to buy supplemental insurance, be it long-term disability, whatever. Everybody's got something. When you look at your paycheck, there's always for your 401k, something. Doesn't seem to cost anything for you, does it? So now what they're saying is this is just too onerous. We can't do this. It's ridiculous. Just plain ridiculous. Now, when you step back and you look at it for what it is, these are people who don't believe in government. These are people who want to make it small enough they can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. It's not surprising to me because there are so many things that need to be done. Last time I checked, Pennsylvania was, depending on which report you read, 47th or 49th in job creation. Yet what we're focusing on is something that costs us nothing and will accomplish nothing but harming a handful of workers to start. We have an education system that is in a shambles because we've had a governor who's basically defunded it. And to me, this is another one of those shiny things in the room. It's, hey, look over here. You know, I've spent 44 minutes now talking about this issue because I think it's that important right now. But over the long haul, it's going to harm our state, not just harm our workers, it's going to harm the entire state because how much time and energy are we taking away from things that we really need to get done? So as I said, to me, this is, you should be calling your legislator, especially if it's a Republican, and say, look, at the end of this, you know, whatever your disagreements are, stabbing somebody in the back, this ain't it. Especially since it costs us nothing. And I would call and ask what the motive is. Call and say, hey, you know, I'm a constituent. I want to know what's behind this. Why is this something we're even considering? Now, if they tell you this is the next step on the way to pushing right-to-work legislation, at least they're honest. And then you know. Because to me, this is that first step. Because Pennsylvania is not ready for that yet. They've got to prime the voters. They've got to prime us for that. There's a lot of education or re-education. Maybe put us into some camps. Now, me, I'm all in favor of a right to work. You go back to the origination of the term when labor was using it to say every man or person who wants a job should have the right to a job. That's not what this is. Man, everybody thinks, oh, yeah, we should have a right to work. That's not what this is. Now, you bring me something that says we have a right, I'm with you. There's no right here, and there's no work here. That simple. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
One 888 520 Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Something on your mind? Question? Comment? Something you want to chime in on? Our quote of the day comes from Paul Krugman. He writes, "At this point, the rise of the 1% at the expense of everyone else is so obvious that it is no longer possible to shut down any discussion of rising inequality with cries of class warfare," which is why, and you know, look, I agree with Krugman. I agree with him a lot, which is why you're seeing a change in topic. Scott Perry, the congressman in my area, he was on fake news on Fox trumpeting the change. And it's all going to be about Iraq in the this coming week. Got to change the message, because obviously Republicans have lost the, "Oh, I really care about the poor" argument. And the Chris Christie thing you can't really defend. So we need a change of topic. Now, I got an email during the break from Andy who said, you know, no question, Republican policies murder poor people. Kind of a strong position. He said, in regard to your 10-9 program, for that matter, you don't even have to be poor and they'll murder you. Just disagree with their policies or be working class. And he goes into talking about LaPortia Massey. For those of you who don't remember, in September, this was a sixth grade little girl who went to school in the morning, ended up having an asthma attack at school, ended up dying later in the day. And the school that she attended had no nurse. Who you would hope that if the school had a nurse would have noticed that she was having an asthma attack and gotten her the help that she needed. And this is all goes back to the Corbett budget, which Andy points out. He said there's no reason for it. In the wealthiest country on the planet, there is not a reason for a school not to have a nurse. He said, when the election for governor rolls around, remember LaPortia, she was murdered. And he points in very, very stark terms. He says, look, Republican Party policy will kill kids. Republican policies kill, remember. And it's a bit harsh. But can you when you see the money coming out of education, when you see the fact that this governor has not done anything really to help get people health care. In fact, one of his first decisions was to kick 41,000 working people off of adult basic. You have to go. It's a matter of priorities, folks. It's a matter of priorities. So, here's another one of those moments. And remember this, because as I said a second ago, the Republicans have lost that we care. And I think they're about ready to give up on the messaging of saying they even care. Because as the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette pointed out, I think it was yesterday, that the state Senate president is about to, Joe Scarnati, is about to introduce legislation to go after those welfare cheats. Now, those poor people who get food stamps. Those cheats. Evidently, he wants to increase the penalties for fraud and make the limit at which, you know, the threshold to be a felony, he wants to drop that from $3,000 down to $1,000, of course, impose higher fees if you've lost your card, and, you know, some other things that they want to throw in there. Now, he comes from a county where the poverty rate's about 14.5%. You compare that statewide, a little over 13%. So he comes from a county where a lot of people are in need. And yet here again, what you're going to see is another conservative kind of politician with constituents going against what the constituents actually need. Now, Pennsylvania, we've got about 1.8 million people who receive supplemental nutrition assistance program, food stamps. There are about 2.2 million people here in the Commonwealth that use Medicaid. Now, you think about this, you go, if we could get those people to vote, don't you think maybe we'd get the Medicaid expansion money? Don't you think the priority would be there? Now, remember, back in 2012, Corbett and the Republicans instituted a means test for food stamps. If you're under 60 years old and you have assets of more than $5,500, sorry, you're disqualified. If you're disabled and over 60 and you have assets of more than $9,000, you're disqualified. So you've got to be poor, really poor. You can't just have hit a rough spot, and we're not going to help you through. You've got to be basically indigent in these people's mind for you to get anything. Now, the way they also want to propose a cap on how much, I guess he's upset because people have nice cars when they hit a rough spot. So if you've got a nice car, you know, you're going to be exempt. You're going to be disqualified from getting food stamps. And I guess he would put the value of that car at $35,000. Now, I guess you're going to have a whole lot of time going through a process because, you know, you're going to look at my 2011 Jeep and go, well, that's obviously not worth $35,000, but we still have to do all the paperwork, and we still got to fill out and dot the T's and cross the I's and do all of that stuff. You kind of got to wonder, doesn't it seem like a lot of obstacle, a lot of busy work? Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? The point is to make this whole process really difficult, really invasive, and really very punitive in my mind. And the sad thing is you know, from people I've talked to, Scarnati isn't even really that insanely far right. To me, again, this is more of the puppeteer going, hey, there's money here. This is the way I'm being pushed. This is the way this is where the money's telling me to go. Now, you look at, you know, a study that was done back in 2012. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the fraud rate for food stamps is about close to 1 cent on a dollar in the entire program. It's less than 1%. And I go back to, you know, what I said earlier with Dave Feldman. There are so many things out there that really, truly, honestly need to be looked at. There are so many issues that we should be spending our time on. Do you think we should be spending a whole boatload of time on something that has a fraud rate of less than 1%? Do you think the credit card companies would be doing backflips if they had less than 1% of fraud? You name the agency. I mean, it's amazing to me how little fraud there is in the food stamp, in the SNAP program. Because it works. People use it the way they're supposed to. Now, do you have a couple of ding-dongs? Yeah, you do. And you deal with them. I would say, you know, Mr. Scarnati, if you really want to find waste, fraud, and abuse, take a look at the handouts that we give to these big corporations. Take a look at the money that we give away in tax abatement, the money that we give away in land grants and no-interest loans, and all of the economic development money we get that's supposed to be creating jobs but never has any clawback. It was supposed to be creating jobs but never really lives up to what we're sold. And what we end up getting is, well, the check. And our kids go to schools that have bigger class sizes, less resources. The poor in our community end up using health care in the most expensive mean possible. But yet here we are. Got to go after those people. You got to go after them. Man, there are such bigger fish to fry. And am I advocating people to cheat the system? No, obviously not. But when you look at the amount of money that we give to these huge corporations, it's mind-blowing. When we have so many needs and so many things that we could be better spending our tax dollars on. And I look at all the money we've wasted on these privatization schemes and all of this stuff that really, honestly and truthfully, in the grand scheme of the state, doesn't do us a hill of beans. And I'm hoping the more we uncover this stuff, the more we talk about this, the more outraged we're going to be, the more angry we're going to be. Because we sent those people to Harrisburg to do a job for us, not to be engaged in this political backbiting and this stabbing people that they don't agree with in the back, and definitely not stealing assets and selling it off to their friends so they can get their next job. At least that's not the reason I voted for someone. Lots to do, folks. Let's take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. You can email me, rick@ricksmithshow.com. And for more information, ricksmithshow.com. Right back with Hour 2. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan is launching a new campaign today at the Detroit Auto Show called Labor Rights Are Civil Rights. Nissan workers are joining clergy, the Mississippi NAACP, elected officials, civil rights activists, and students to launch this new campaign aimed at making people aware of the struggle to organize the Camden, Mississippi auto plant. Workers there are attempting to join the United Auto Workers as they push Nissan agree to a fair union election free of intimidation and threats from the employer. Even as Mississippi workers launch their labor rights or civil rights campaign in Detroit, North Carolina's Moral Monday movement is spreading through the South. After drawing thousands of protesters and inspiring the arrests of more than 900 people in civil disobedience protest actions, Georgia will see its first Moral Monday at the state capitol there. The Georgia NAACP is leading that protest, but the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement will be at the Georgia protest today. In South Carolina, progressive protesters
protesters will greet the state's legislature as it convenes Tuesday for a Moral Monday-style protest billed as Truthful Tuesday. These protests challenge the extreme right-wing agendas of Republican-dominated state governments in the South. The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO has a message for U.S. Congressman Ron Kind. Knock off the support for trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they are no good for workers or for farmers. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
We have no evidence, and he's presented none, nor has anyone else, that any of these trade agreements do any good for the workers. U.S. dairy farmers are going to lose over $20 billion in 10 years. And everyone knows Wisconsin's a pretty big dairy state.
The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO Central Labor Council has sent Congressman Ron Kind a copy of Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's book, Myths of Free Trade, Why American Trade Policy Has Failed, in an effort to enlighten the congressman about trade policy. Global labor organizations are protesting the gunning down of striking Cambodian garment workers January 3rd. The workers were killed by Cambodian military using AK-47 assault rifles. The government has banned demonstrations and is using the military to control the streets. The violence ended the strike. Industrial, Uni Global Union, the International Trade Union Confederation, the Cambodia Labor Confederation, and Workers United are all demanding that the Cambodian government stop the violence, restore freedom of association and assembly, release the detained workers and drop any charges against them, and resume negotiations for an increase in the minimum wage. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Labor Federation is deeply disappointed in the U.S. State Department for allowing Indian consular officer Devyani Kobragati to escape visa fraud charges through diplomatic immunity. The charges came after a domestic worker fled working conditions that approached human trafficking, according to Trumka. Trumka says the indictment against the Indian diplomat was a positive step in the movement to uphold the rights of domestic workers, and Trumka says the American labor movement will continue to stand by Sangeeta Richard and domestic workers' family as they adjust to life in the U.S.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've been following this story in West Virginia, the Freedom Water, yes, we love our water with toxic sludge or, you know, what kind of chemical? I can't even pronounce the name of the chemical, so I'm not going to try and butcher it. But it's just, you know, I go back and I think of all of these things that have been spilled into our water. And, you know, as someone who grew up in Cleveland, what I say, home of the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts. I remember as a kid, we had, you know, the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, we had given corporate America carte blanche. Go ahead, man, pollute all you want. The water's there, just whatever. And I remember as a kid, you know, growing up, you could never go swimming in Lake Erie. The fish, they only floated sideways. For those of you who don't know, they're dead. And the ones that you did see that were floating sideways usually had a bunch of weird growths on them because who knew what was in the water? Because these kind of spills happened all the time. And there was nothing there to stop it. So, you know, when I hear people say, well, what we need, Rick, is we need to deregulate. We need to let these industries go. I say, well, I got to think about that a couple of times because every regulation that we've put into place, understand this. Every regulation we've put into place has been the result of something happening or a bunch of somethings. Now, I understand there are things that you go, wow, that was maybe a little bit excessive, and we'll scale it back a touch, maybe adjust, but to say we're just going to deregulate, which is what we've been hearing for generation, or at least a generation now. You know, thanks to the Reagan era, we need deregulation. You know, think about the airline industry. How competitive is the airline industry since we allowed competition to take over? Oh, yeah, it's not. We're at monopoly status right now. Same thing with the trucking companies. How'd deregulation do for the trucking industry? It has made it a poverty industry. So on the day that this spill was reported, the U.S. House of Representatives, this was last Thursday, they passed a bill that basically overhauled our hazardous waste laws. They called it the Reducing Excessive Deadline Obligation Act. passed through by a vote of 225 to 188. Four Republicans voted against it. Five Democrats voted for it. So we could say it was bipartisan. Nonsense. You got five corporate Democrats who voted for it. And four Republicans with a conscience. You figure that one out. What this did is they amended both the Solid Waste Disposal Act and the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, the Superfund Act. I find it, and now, it's one of those ironies of when you look at something, you go, wow, this horrible thing happened, and they wanted to make it worse. The New York Times reported today that, oddly enough, this company, Freedom Industries, had the freedom to not be inspected in something like 20 years. And also had the freedom to basically, the way I'm reading it is they were exempt. They were exempt from EPA regulations for this, what was just a horrible, horrible tragedy. And, you know, you go back and you stop and you think about it. And you go, how did they get exempt? Well, heavy lobbying and lots of money. And the Republican right-wing pro-corporate, and there's some Democrats that fall into this, view that regulations are bad. Or as Michelle Bachmann said, the job-killing EPA, we don't want them in. So the newspaper in Charleston, West Virginia, did a story on the owners of Freedom Industries. You know, the company that's responsible for 300,000 people there in the Kanawha Valley. You know, 300,000 of them not having water. Evidently, the company was founded by a two-time convicted felon, which, you know, hey, we all make mistakes, right? You know, if not paying your taxes and selling cocaine are those mistakes, fine. Also got 2009 federal stimulus money. Think about that. Now, what the newspaper is saying is that the executives of Freedom Industries, they've completely avoided the media. But the one time that they did say something was Friday at like a little press conference where the guy's statement was beautiful. One of the founders, Gary Southern, he said, our friends and our neighbors, this incident is extremely, extremely unfortunate, unanticipated, and we are very, very sorry. Very sorry for the disruption to everyone's daily life that this incident has caused. It has been an extremely long day. I'm having trouble talking at the moment. I would appreciate it if we could wrap this thing up. I said, I'm sorry. Isn't that enough? Basically, that's his response. It's enough. I said, I'm sorry already, right? And then you get into the nitty-gritty of the article where the only person who will talk about it is the soon-to-be wife of one of the moneyed interests who was the ex of another one. Kind of a whole incestuous relationship. Not sure why the article went into it, but they're the only one. She's the only one that would talk. Now, the part that gets me is Freedom Industries, really heavily tied to the Chamber of Commerce, tied to the Koch brothers. Oddly enough, they're all in this together. And got a boatload of money from the stimulus so that the Army Corps of Engineers could come in and dredge the place, the river, where they polluted. And the article points out in a very nice way that on Saturday, Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers front group, came in and set up a water distribution site at the Columbia Gas in Charleston. So if you didn't have, you could go get a bottle of water from Americans for Prosperity. And I'll bet you they had a sign-up table there saying, all these onerous regulations are killing us. I gotta say, it's quite comical on one vein that the people who are behind what happened are the people handing you a touch of help. Now, you know, I think about this whole incestuous relationship that we've allowed these these corporations through the Chamber of Commerce, really. I mean, that's, to me, you want to talk about a terrorist group? Here's one. The damage, the degradation, the destruction of our country under the guise of we need to be more business friendly is a bit too much at this point. You know, I go back to when I was in Cleveland. I remember one of the pipelines that they had running through Lake Erie had burst. And it was months, I guess, before they knew. And there were several hundred thousand gallons of or barrels of toluene that were leaked into the lake. And as I remember it, and you think about all of these things, as I remember it, you and I, the taxpayers, we end up paying for it. Company files bankruptcy, the liabilities on the government, and so you'll either cover it or you won't. And you'll have to deal with it. And what I find interesting is you look at this whole incestuous relationship of, and the reason I think the reason they brought up this woman who is the felon's ex-wife marrying off the other partner is she had the audacity to say that she brushed her teeth this morning and she didn't get sick. think about that. I brushed my teeth today. I think I was just fine. And she showered. And that's, I guess, a nice thing. Here's my problem. And I guess I have a lot of problems with this. You've got these companies that are making all this money, and you know, this company evidently was a storage facility for these chemicals, which evidently were exempted by the EPA, which you would think if they're storing chemicals underground, and you got to ask the question, how many of these chemicals are being stored in abandoned mines? How much of this stuff are we just throwing down holes? How much are we high pressure injecting into the ground? We never really seem to have a conversation of where all of this hazardous material ends up. I remember a couple of years back, they wanted in Cleveland to put hazardous waste, the radioactive hazardous waste from hospitals in the salt mines under the lake. I said, oh, you know, it's not much of a chance that it would ever leak into the water supply. And then you go, well, what about the earthquakes you're creating from the high-pressure injection into the ground? Well, couldn't that possibly, you know, maybe crack one of these things? And, well, don't worry about it. Or as my grandfather always said, don't worry about it. In 100 years, you'll never know. And maybe that's our environmental policy. In 100 years, you'll never worry about it. You'll never know it, so don't worry about it. Aren't you tired of that? I mean, because as we deregulate, as we say, hey, don't worry about it, don't you think these things are going to happen more often? And maybe we don't even hear about it. I mean, the fact that 300,000 people were affected, you got to wonder if no one notices immediately and they can pawn it off on something else. Don't you think they do it? And the thing that gets me is, you know, you look at this, and I think the chemical was something like methocycline, hexane, methanol or something, causes vomiting, causes headaches, causes, you know, irritation of the eyes, nose, and throat, skin rashes, uncontrollable vomiting. And, you know, the reality is, the guy who was the president of the West Virginia American Water Company said that they don't really know when the water will be safe to drink again. But he said, I can't ballpark because I don't know. But today they said, oh, let's go ahead. Never mind. Got to quell the fear of the people. They haven't been able to pinpoint when the leak started. And they don't really know specifically how much. So the question that I keep having is, how long has this been going on? How much of this stuff, if you were a citizen of in this area, drinking this water, living in this area, wouldn't you want to know when it started? Well, since it hasn't been inspected, and someone said, I think I read somewhere like 20 years, just a thought, do you think maybe possibly it could have been leaking for quite some time and you've been consuming this for quite some time? See, this is my problem when you get into this. We don't need no stinking regulation. We don't need no inspectors. We don't need no busybody, nosy folk coming around. And that's not just West Virginia. It's all over the place. This is what happens. Because then you don't know. Now, I got to wonder. How long has it been going on? How much of it have you already ingested? I mean, there's so many of these questions. And the thing that gets me, when we did our labor history tour, and we ended up in West Texas, and we saw the explosion site of the fertilizer plant there in West Texas. I remember saying at the time, going, you know, nobody knew that the potential was here, or no one cared. Or, you know, it's the mentality, oh, it can't happen here. Or the other mentality of, we don't care. We won't be held liable for it. And, you know, I like when my Republican friend said, you know, Rick, you know, the companies, they don't want to get sued, so they'll do the right thing. You kind of got to wonder, don't you? I know I'm quite frustrated by this. Because you've got a regime that has a grip of the Republican Party saying, we don't need these regulations. We don't need oversight. You and I should read that as us be damned. Because, yeah, maybe the company's going to get sued, but are you going to get your life back? Sad stuff. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I had this pledge of allegiance memorized by the age of 6 and recited it countless numbers of times as a student and young man. And I continue to find appropriate places to recite the pledge still today. But it's so often the case, I eventually found out that it wasn't always like this. When America entered the last decade of the 1800s, our Pledge of Allegiance did not exist. Mr. Daniel Sharp Ford, the owner of Youth's Companion magazine, and his marketer, James Upham, are both credited with developing the idea of adopting a Pledge of Allegiance in 1892 to help close the remaining wounds of the Civil War. But join us again to meet the author. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Perhaps you thought the political world was finally safe from the dynamic duo of Ford and Raydell. But no, here they come, rushing back into the limelight. Rob Ford, the explosive mayor of Toronto, became a global punchline last fall when a video showed his honor smoking crack cocaine. Then came little blow-ups involving sexual harassment, a murder threat, knocking down a city councilwoman, and drunken rages. Yet, on January 2nd, Rob was back, filing for re-election and blurting out that my record speaks for itself. Well, he's right about that. Even less charming is Trey Raydell, a first-term Congress critter from Fort Myers, Florida. His chief accomplishment in Washington was getting arrested last October for trying to buy cocaine from an undercover cop. But rather than humbly stepping down, or even quieting down, Trey called a December press conference to announce that he's healed. Having completed a 28-day treatment program for addiction, though apparently not for narcissism, the former TV anchorman declared himself fit to return to what I do, what you sent me to do in Washington. Presumably, that does not include scuttling around back alleys seeking drugs and drink. Raydell said that, thanks to God and family, he's a changed man. For one thing, while he still insists that poor families should be subjected to drug tests in order to get food stamps, he has slightly amended that Dickensian stance. I think members of Congress should be tested as well, he said with a straight face. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Raydell wants poor people's food stamps automatically taken away if they're caught using drugs. But a lawmaker who gets nabbed can keep drawing his $170,000 a year government salary. Still, that doesn't make Raydell a hypocrite, because, as Stephen Colbert points out, lawmakers don't get food stamps.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I was thinking about this just a minute ago, and I you know, it's one of those things that kind of sticks with you. You know, I remember, you know, you being a kid going down to the beach on Edgewater Park in Cleveland, and there being signs you can't go in. And I remember, you know, my mother going, you know, why can't we go in? Well, they're cleaning up the pollution. And, you know, even as a kid, you go, well, how did it get so bad? How did we allow this to happen? And, you know, my mother really didn't have the answers for that. And it's always been something that I've wondered. As you see these fish wash up on the beach and you see the water, which is, you know, at the time they were saying stay out of, because it's, who knows what's going to happen to you. And I don't think up until the mid-80s, I don't think I saw anyone in the water. I mean, it was one of those things that was very, very strange. I guess it was the early 80s. They had introduced the zebra mussels, and the zebra mussels, which have now taken over, did actually clean up the water as they were supposed to. It's just now that they've completely taken over and clog everything up because no natural predator. So they just multiply with no bounds. But did their job, cleaned up the water. And maybe that's what it's going to take. Maybe we need zebra mussels. In corporate America, maybe we need somebody who is going to say, you know what, we've done enough of this. And, you know, to bring this back to our conversation in the first hour, unions are one of those groups that actually raise their hand and say something. And I don't know if I've told, I think I may have told this story in the past. You know, I was working at a place, at a warehouse, where they had like a maintenance shop. The warehouse was unionized, the maintenance shop was not. And I remember, you know, one of the maintenance guys going, you know, the supervisor told me to take this 55-gallon drum of oil and dump it out back. He goes, I don't want to do that. Had no choice, because the supervisor told him, your choice is don't do it and get fired. So he told one of the union guys, and one of the union guys got a steward, and the steward said, hey, whoa, you're not doing that. We're not going to let you do that. In fact, we'll call the appropriate party if you don't dispose of it properly. The union saving the company from itself and its own greed. I got to wonder, of the 30 or 40 employees at this Freedom Industries, I got to wonder if any of them knew. And, you know, we've been calling around all day trying to find guests to come on from West Virginia and talk about it. And even the quote-unquote liberal groups have been less than receptive to want to talk about it. Because understand, coal rules West Virginia. And what this company did was a feeder for the coal industry. So, you know, to me, you got to start asking bigger questions. you know, because I have friends who live in West Virginia who say, you know, there are these huge dams that have this slurry stuff. And, you know, not being from a mining background, I can only imagine what slurry is. But I guess it's all of the muck and all of the, you know, the residue from the mines and all of the chemicals and this whole, the whole stew of the process, if you will. This nasty, toxic, black stew that, from what I'm told, have these huge dams holding back millions and millions of barrels of this stuff that are just, at any minute, you know, just ready to blow. And you've got to wonder how many of these kind of storage sites have we allowed to be set up. In fact, you know, one of my friends, Bob Kincaid, who does the program at the Head On Radio Network, Head On with Bob Kincaid, he said that there's one place that has, it's almost as big as the Hoover Dam, I guess, and it's being held back, it's holding back, you know, millions of barrels of this stuff, and it's leaking at the foot. So the footer's leaking, and that's a bad thing, just so you know, because if it's leaking down there, eventually that will erode, and it's gonna pop loose. And if you think the breach in Tennessee was bad, where, you know, thousands of acres of land were contaminated from this stuff because they had a breach, wait till one of these goes. And as he was explaining it to me, he says, you know, within, you know, half a mile or something, there's an elementary school. And they, when they did worst case scenario, they said, well, about 5,000 people will die when it cuts loose. So you've got these people who live in this community who are looking at this thing that we've allowed to be created, going, that's probably what's going to kill me. And yet the Republicans in the House passed a law to change how we regulate storage facilities. You got to kind of wonder at some point in our political process, when do you and I matter? When do working people matter? You got to wonder how much exposure to these chemicals these workers have had. You got to kind of wonder, don't you? I mean, at some point, doesn't it beg the question? Now, look, this is one very small company. How many more are out there? Are there any in our neighborhood? You know, I remember talking to somebody about the West Texas thing, and you know, they said, well, it wasn't a big deal to have the plant there. It was always there. Nobody ever thought it was a problem. Until kaboom. Bunch of people dead, 93-foot hole 10 feet deep in the ground, a school with all the windows blown out, a nursing home with the roof and all the windows blown out, homes for as far around as you could see with their windows blown off their foundations. Never really thought about it. I got to wonder if they were thinking about, maybe if we'd have regulated better. Maybe if we'd have paid more attention. Maybe if we'd have done an inspection more than once every 20 years. Do you think? And, you know, I don't ever hear the Republicans standing on a site like that saying, see, if we would have deregulated, this wouldn't have happened, because we know better. Which is why we need to have sane, rational policy. Why we need to have sane, rational regulation. Look, I'm in favor of looking at our regulatory bodies and then funding them to do what they need to do. Where the Republicans have won this battle every step of the way is they have defunded our regulatory bodies. What, OSHA? What, they can inspect every workplace in this country in 111 years? Really? Sad stuff. I'm going to take a quick break when we come back and talk a little bit about, you know, what kind of regulations should we be having? What things should we be doing? And, you know, we need to have effective government. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rich Smith Show.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan is launching a new campaign today at the Detroit Auto Show called Labor Rights Are Civil Rights. Nissan workers are joining clergy, the Mississippi NAACP, elected officials, civil rights activists, and students to launch this new campaign aimed at making people aware of the struggle to organize the Canton, Mississippi auto plant. Workers there are attempting to join the United Auto Workers as they push Nissan to agree to a fair union election free of intimidation and threats from the employer. Even as Mississippi workers launch their labor rights or civil rights campaign in Detroit, North Carolina's Moral Monday movement is spreading through the South. After drawing thousands of protesters and inspiring the arrests of more than 900 people in civil disobedience protest actions, Georgia will see its first Moral Monday at the state capitol there. The Georgia NAACP is leading that protest, but the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement will be at the Georgia protest today. In South Carolina, progressive protesters will greet the state's legislature as it convenes Tuesday for a Moral Monday-style protest billed as Truthful Tuesday. These protests challenge the extreme right-wing agendas of Republican-dominated state governments in the South. The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO has a message for U.S. Congressman Ron Kind. Knock off the support for trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they are no good for workers or for farmers. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
We have no evidence, and he's presented none, nor has anyone else, that any of these trade agreements do any good for the workers. U.S. dairy farmers are going to lose over $20 billion in 10 years. And yet one knows Wisconsin's a pretty big dairy state.
The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO Central Labor Council has sent Congressman Ron Kind a copy of Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's book, Myths of Free Trade, Why American Trade Policy Has Failed, in an effort to enlighten the congressman about trade policy. Global labor organizations are protesting the gunning down of striking Cambodian garment workers January 3rd. The workers were killed by Cambodian military using AK-47 assault rifles. The government has banned demonstrations and is using the military to control the streets. The violence ended the strike. Industrial, Uni Global Union, the International Trade Union Confederation, the Cambodia Labor Confederation, and Workers United are all demanding that the Cambodian government stop the violence, restore freedom of association and assembly, release the detained workers and drop any charges against them, and resume negotiations for an increase in the minimum wage. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Labor Federation is deeply disappointed in the U.S. State Department for allowing Indian consular officer Devyani Kobragati to escape visa fraud charges through diplomatic immunity. The charges came after a domestic worker fled working conditions that approached human trafficking, according to Trumka. Trumka says the indictment against the Indian diplomat was a positive step in the movement to uphold the rights of domestic workers, and Trumka says the American labor movement will continue to stand by Sangeeta Richard and the domestic worker's family as they adjust to life in the U.S.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third one I can't, sorry, oops.
Well, it's funny to hear, you know, Ron Paul there kind of helping him, chiming in, trying to help him. I'm sure if it was Michelle Bachmann, she'd have gone after the EPA, because we've heard her say in the past, you know, the job-killing EPA. You know, I look at this thing in West Virginia, and I got to be honest, you know, I want stronger regulations. I want to make sure this stuff doesn't happen. And it's odd to me that on the very day that this happens, House Republicans moved to repeal part of our law on how we store hazardous chemicals. It's just, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Anyway, here to talk about what kind of regulations should we have is Ronald White. He's Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government. ForEffectiveGov.org is their website. Ronald, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this thing in West Virginia. Evidently, they haven't been inspected in 20 years. And evidently have gotten an exemption from the EPA. You kind of look at this and go, you know, maybe if there was someone there to inspect it, maybe just once in the last 20 years, potentially could we have avoided a catastrophe like this? I don't know.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we have a patchwork of laws right now in terms of how we deal with chemicals in this country. We are dealing with the major law, which was passed in 1976, and it wasn't a particularly strong law at that time, and it's clearly now way out of date and really become ineffective in terms of how we deal with chemicals in our environment.
You know, for the last 30 years, Ronald, we've heard that, well, we need to get out of business's way. We need to be more business friendly. Cause, you know, as Michelle Bachmann says, you know, the EPA is a job killing organization. And, you know, we've been sold this message time and time again. At what point do we wake up and realize that it's not good for us?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the situation in Charleston certainly drives home, you know, what some of the issues are, and it's, difficult as that situation has been down in Charleston, frankly, you know, things have been a lot worse. We've got chemical accidents all over the country with facilities that have had major accidents. In fact, even in the West Virginia area down by Charleston several years ago, we had a chemical plant that had a major accident, had an explosion and killed two workers. Chemical Safety Board that investigates these kinds of problems, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, went down there, investigated it, made some recommendations. This was an accident that occurred down in Institute, West Virginia, which is down in the Kanawha Valley, and that told the state that they needed to develop a new program to prevent accidents and accidental releases. And unfortunately, nothing had ever happened in West Virginia to respond to the Chemical Safety Board's suggestions.
I like that. They made suggestions. Don't you think we need something more than maybe a little more powerful than just suggestions?
Absolutely. But the Chemical Safety Board, is the way it's created, has no regulatory policy, has no regulatory power, I should say. They're there to investigate and then make recommendations. But certainly, you know, we're really facing a situation in this country where not only do we need stronger regulations to prevent the kinds of accidents and hazards that we're seeing down in Charleston right now, but we don't even really have good information about the potential hazards of the vast majority of chemicals that we're dealing with in society right now. A lot of the chemicals that are in products, that are in materials, were never tested and were grandfathered in under the regulations that came out of the Toxic Substance Control Act, which is that legislation that I was talking about that was passed in 1976. And we have now more than 80,000 chemicals in commerce, and just barely a couple hundred of them have actually gone through some adequate testing to determine just how hazardous they are. And that's a significant problem and one that we're going to really have to deal with if we're going to try and get a handle on understanding how we deal with chemicals in our environment and our daily lives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's infuriating to me is that we only seem to talk about these things after there's a catastrophe like this, after hundreds of thousands of people are affected in an acute way. We don't really ever talk about the chronic problems that are in our things in our water, things in our air. Because someone said to me that there's the water in West Virginia is back to an acceptable level of contamination, and that just seemed to be kind of idiotic.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, first of all, there's some real questions about this particular situation on how this acceptable level was determined. It really, unfortunately, we're dealing with very limited data to be able to even decide what a safe level ought to be. It really goes, again, back to the situation where we just don't have good toxic data, good toxicological data in terms of understanding what the health risks are from most of the chemicals that we're dealing with in the environment. So, you know, clearly, you know, an acceptable level of contamination at this point is really, to a certain extent, yes. Now, we're not saying, you know, I'm certainly not going to say that it's unhealthy, but I'm saying that I think what clearly is the case here is there isn't enough information to really say with some confidence that we really understand what the long-term effects might be of exposure. Fortunately, this is a situation where we hope that after some time, nature will take care of the problem. The chemical will be diluted enough in the water that people won't be impacted. But, you know, you're absolutely right. We deal with these things on a crisis basis and then try to react afterwards. And you know, and are being told that this is just the price of business as usual.
Yeah, you know, you were talking a second ago about the, you know, what it does to us and the research done. I found interesting in the newspaper in Charleston that wrote a report on it. The fiance of one of the executives for the company, Freedom Industries, because nothing says freedom like drinking toxic water. One of the fiance of the one of the executives, since none of the executives are talking, they got the fiance to said that she showered and brushed her teeth with the water and she was just fine. So everything's got to be wonderful if she showered and brushed her teeth and she was just fine.
Well, you know, I'm glad she feels that she's just fine. I wish I had as much confidence.
So in looking at this, so moving forward, because the message to me is very simply, maybe if we take a proactive approach instead of this reactionary stance of okay, it's happened, now we're going to send in whatever the agency you said who made the suggestions, and nothing's going to get done. Maybe we take a proactive stance and say, you know what, if you're going to have these kind of facilities, maybe we should take a look at them to make sure that there are safety procedures in place, that if there is a breach, that there's a secondary way of capturing this stuff before it goes directly into the one thing on the one of the two things on this earth we absolutely cannot live without, and that's our water. Maybe just a thought?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think it even goes down to something even more common sense, like, you know, should we be storing toxic chemicals in facilities that are literally right next to rivers where we're taking our drinking water from upstream from wastewater treatment plants, which is what the case was here. I mean, in the long term, we need to think about where we're siting these kinds of facilities, certainly to some better thinking about containment so that we have a backup plan so that if these kinds of problems do occur, first of all, we know about it. Apparently, in this particular case, it was several hours before anybody even knew about the fact that these tanks, that the tank was leaking. And the way they found out about it was not from testing the water. It's because people were complaining about the odor coming out of the chemicals that was coming off the chemicals. And people then were complaining to the environmental agency about air problems, that they were having this sickly sweet smell odor. And at that point, the air folks at the West Virginia Environmental Agency contacted the water folks to say, we may need to go out and check what's going on here. So it took apparently several hours for the agency even to become aware of the fact, because there really was no monitoring of these kinds of containers in West Virginia. The fact is that in West Virginia, you don't have to, there are no regulations that relate to monitoring these facilities because they only store the chemical, they don't produce them. That's not the case in some other states, but that was the case in West Virginia, and it's certainly come back to haunt them.
Yeah, I got to wonder how many other states.
Well, there are quite a few. I mean, I don't have the numbers right
now. And you got to wonder if Pennsylvania is one of them, because, you know, right now we're doing this. I don't know if you know anything about fracking, but we're pumping these hazardous chemicals, these carcinogens, deep underground, and they tell us they're collecting it and storing it, shipping it on our roads over to Ohio, where they're pumping it underground in these high pressure injection sites that evidently are causing little earthquakes. But that's okay. That's just the cost of commerce.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Center for Effective Government's been very involved and interested in this issue of the chemicals that are used in fracking, and we work with a coalition. We co-chair the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, which is a group of many organizations, some environmental and some others that are involved with public health and consumer protection and others. But there are a lot of organizations as part of the coalition that are also very concerned about the water quality impact of fracking, the air quality impacts of fracking, of which they're significant as well, the land use implications of fracking. So there are a whole host of issues that are associated with fracking that I know are very important to the people of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, which is why I thought it interesting that our governor and the legislature here in Pennsylvania thought it important in Act 13 to take away local control and local say. If you are going to have fracking in your community or not, they wanted to consolidate that power into the hands of the state. So if Range Resource or one of the big drillers says, hey, we know there's gas over there, we want it, they don't even have to deal with the local community. They got carte blanche. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a real concern, and it was certainly a relief that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made the decision it did about the ability of local communities to have some ability to have a say in the type of fracking situation that might be going on in their communities, because that's certainly an important issue.
Yeah.
Local communities are directly impacted by fracking, and they need to have a say in whether or not they want that in the community, and if they do, how it's done, to make sure that if it is done, that it's done at least in a way that it's going to wind up protecting the resources, protecting the health of the people who live there.
Because at the end of all of it, it's the local people who are going to end up bearing the brunt of the costs, not just health-wise, but also financially. Because, you know, I look at this and I go, how much are you going to get from Freedom Industries? I don't know how much money and liability they've got, but how much are you going to get to clean this mess up and all of the problems that they've created?
Absolutely. And clearly, there's going to be a cost involved. I don't know the details in terms of the kind of insurance that hopefully this chemical company has, but ultimately the costs associated with just the Charleston situation are very significant in terms of the costs that are associated, never mind the direct cost of supplying water to all those people who didn't have water for several days, but the indirect costs. They've talked about the amount of lost business to the businesses in the whole Charleston area. Those are very significant costs, and again, we're fortunate that there were no serious injuries, at least that we have been able to identify so far.
Right.
And there are several people who complained about skin irritation and respiratory irritation, but fortunately, the numbers are relatively small, and the acute cases seem to be not that significant. Health consequences, but this is very lucky. I mean, I think clearly, they dodged the bullet in Charleston. Things could have been much, much worse, and it really is a wake-up call, I think, for the country in terms of how we deal with chemicals in our society, and the need to do a much better job of ensuring that we have safeguards so that these kinds of problems don't occur, which means, as you pointed out, better inspection, more inspection, smarter ways of siting these kinds of facilities, smarter ways of ensuring that there are backup systems in place to capture these pollutants if they do escape from an accident.
Yeah, but you'll be happy to know that Americans for Prosperity, they were there on Saturday to hand out bottled water just so that, they would know everyone's okay and to promote more deregulation. Because to me, you look at this and the very people who caused this are the very people out there going, oh, here, we understand. We're so sorry for your loss. But we're still going to push our poison.
Yeah. I think the idea here that somehow we're overregulating chemical industry and it's just actually the flip side. We really need to do more to make sure that we've got the safeguards in place to ensure that these facilities operate properly, that they are taking the precautions they need to take, that they have the backup plans that they need in case there is a problem, and that they're operating these facilities in a way that is going to minimize these kinds of accidents in the future.
Yeah, because the money that you spend up front by not causing these catastrophes is pennies compared to what it's going to cost us now, and who knows what the future holds for who knows what this exposure is going to do to folks. Last question I've got for you. In looking at the aftermath of this, where do you see this going? Will this kind of be a wake up call, or this just be another one of those bumps in the roads that hurries up and we're through with it?
Well, I hope it is a wake up call. There is a push now to finally, after many, many years, to reform the law that deals with chemical pollution in this country, the Toxic Control Act. As I mentioned, it's now more than 40 years old. It wasn't a very strong, effective law to begin with, and there's been some efforts over the last year and a half to try to reform that law and give it some more teeth. Unfortunately, it's still in limbo. It's still currently being negotiated. We have a bill in the Senate that does not do do the job right now. Hopefully it can be strengthened and really address the problem that we've got. So I'm hoping that this kind of accident, this kind of incident, you know, drives home the point to the folks in Washington, but not just in Washington, because there's a lot of action that's going on in the states as well. This really is not just a federal problem. It's a problem that states really need to address as well. So there really needs to be action both at the federal level in terms of reforming the national law, but also ensuring that the states move forward with the kinds of programs to encourage a more proactive, as you pointed out, a more proactive, more upfront effort to try and get a handle on these problems before they hit us, and then we have to wind up cleaning up the mess afterwards.
That is the hope, but sadly, I fear that the message, the moneyed interest, the anti-regulation people have the upper hand, and it's sad to me that it takes a catastrophe to wake us up. But we'll see. Ronald White, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, filling us in on what's going on there. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Ronald White, Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, foreffectivegov.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Ronald's name. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I had this pledge of allegiance memorized by the age of 6 and recited it countless numbers of times as a student and young man. And I continue to find appropriate places to recite the pledge still today. But it's so often the case, I eventually found out that it wasn't always like this. When America entered the last decade of the 1800s, our Pledge of Allegiance did not exist. Mr. Daniel Sharp Ford, the owner of Youth's Companion magazine, and his marketer, James Upham, are both credited with developing the idea of adopting a Pledge of Allegiance in 1892 to help close the remaining wounds of the Civil War. But join us again to meet the author. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Perhaps you thought the political world was finally safe from the dynamic duo of Ford and Raydell. But no, here they come, rushing back into the limelight. Rob Ford, the explosive mayor of Toronto, became a global punchline last fall when a video showed his honor smoking crack cocaine. Then came little blow-ups involving sexual harassment, a murder threat, knocking down a city councilwoman, and drunken rages. Yet, on January 2nd, Rob was back, filing for re-election and blurting out that my record speaks for itself. Well, he's right about that. Even less charming is Trey Raydell, a first-term Congress critter from Fort Myers, Florida. His chief accomplishment in Washington was getting arrested last October for trying to buy cocaine from an undercover cop. But rather than humbly stepping down, or even quieting down, Trey called a December press conference to announce that he's healed. Having completed a 28-day treatment program for addiction, though apparently not for narcissism, the former TV anchorman declared himself fit to return to what I do, what you sent me to do in Washington. Presumably, that does not include scuttling around back alleys seeking drugs and drink. Raydell said that, thanks to God and family, he's a changed man. For one thing, while he still insists that poor families should be subjected to drug tests in order to get food stamps, he has slightly amended that Dickensian stance. I think members of Congress should be tested as well, he said with a straight face. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Raydell wants poor people's food stamps automatically taken away if they're caught using drugs? But a lawmaker who gets nabbed can keep drawing his $170,000 a year government salary. Still, that doesn't make Raydell a hypocrite, because, as Stephen Colbert points out, lawmakers don't get food stamps.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
Yes, I miss Herman Cain. You know, I actually saw his website the other day, and you know, he was pimping this idea that that Walmart's health insurance plan is better than anything Obamacare has to offer, which, you know, ludicrous. Are there some plans? Maybe, if you can afford them at Walmart. And it's like anything. It comes down to what's in the nuts and bolts of the plans. And I got to be honest, the fact that they're making those comparisons, I think is a good idea. Fine, go make it so that we make the other plans better. The idea is that this is how competition was supposed to work. And while I'm not all that thrilled with what came out of the Affordable Care Act, where I think there should have been a lot better, if you want to make the argument that there's competition and that things are going to get better that way, I say, okay, great. Let's get people pushing for better plans, all in favor of it. And maybe at some point we wake up and realize we needed that public option to where we could put pressure, direct pressure on our elected officials to do what they did with Medicare. If you remember 2010, the whole Tea Party thing with everybody screaming, get that government with their greedy hands off my Medicare, without even actually thinking that Medicare is a government program. Part of what came out of the War on Poverty, which just last week celebrated the 50th year. Very successful program. Extraordinarily successful. And it's only been the last several years that you've seen people really trying to succeed at poison pilling it. And I go back to the prescription drug plan, the Medicare Part D, with the advantage and all of that. The poison pill meant to destroy it. And it's odd that it's always Republicans who put these poison pills or these roadblocks or these obstructions into these programs that harm working people, along with their corporate Democrats. I mean, nobody's free from blame, in my view, on a lot of this stuff. But it just seems like all the bad ideas for us, for you and me and our neighbors, come from one political party. But I guess you got to understand whose side are they on. And it's not mine, it's not yours. Let's take a quick break. Right back with the third hour. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast or Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan is launching a new campaign today at the Detroit Auto Show called Labor Rights Are Civil Rights. Nissan workers are joining clergy, the Mississippi NAACP, elected officials, civil rights activists, and students to launch this new campaign aimed at making people aware of the struggle to organize the Canton, Mississippi auto plant. Workers there are attempting to join the United Auto Workers as they push Nissan to agree to a fair union election free of intimidation and threats from the employer. Even as Mississippi workers launch their labor rights or civil rights campaign in Detroit, North Carolina's Moral Monday movement is spreading through the South. After drawing thousands of protesters and inspiring the arrests of more than 900 people in civil disobedience protest actions, Georgia will see its first Moral Monday at the state capitol there. The Georgia NAACP is leading that protest, but the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement will be at the Georgia protest today. In South Carolina, progressive protesters will greet the state's legislature as it convenes Tuesday for a Moral Monday-style protest billed as Truthful Tuesday. These protests challenge the extreme right-wing agendas of Republican-dominated state governments in the South. The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO has a message for U.S. Congressman Ron Kind. Knock off the support for trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they are no good for workers or for farmers. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
We have no evidence, and he's presented none, nor has anyone else, that any of these trade agreements do any good for the workers. U.S. dairy farmers are going to lose over $20 billion in 10 years. I think everyone knows Wisconsin's a pretty big dairy state.
The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO Central Labor Council has sent Congressman Ron Kind a copy of Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's book, Myths of Free Trade, Why American Trade Policy Has Failed, in an effort to enlighten the congressman about trade policy. Global labor organizations are protesting the gunning down of striking Cambodian garment workers January 3rd. The workers were killed by Cambodian military using AK-47 assault rifles. The government has banned demonstrations and is using the military to control the streets. The violence ended the strike. Industrial, Uni Global Union, the International Trade Union Confederation, the Cambodia Labor Confederation, and Workers United are all demanding that the Cambodian government stop the violence, restore freedom of association and assembly, release the detained workers and drop any charges against them, and resume negotiations for an increase in the minimum wage. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Labor Federation is deeply disappointed in the U.S. State Department for allowing Indian consular officer Devyani Kobragadi to escape visa fraud charges through diplomatic immunity. The charges came after a domestic worker fled working conditions that approached human trafficking, according to Trumka. Trumka says the indictment against the Indian diplomat was a positive step in the movement to uphold the rights of domestic workers, and Trumka says the American labor movement will continue to stand by Sangeeta Richard and the domestic workers' family as they adjust to life in the U.S.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job. And the world connected. Your little protest. No memory rejected. It was an inside job. Like it always is. Calculate to businesses.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So at the end of 2013, the unemployment extension ended. No extension as Congress went home. 73,330 people here in Pennsylvania lost their extended unemployment benefits. Actually, they didn't lose them. We just had a Congress that didn't extend them. Now, you know, you think about the average amount of an unemployment benefit here in the Commonwealth, about $343, according to Sanders Levin, the Michigan congressman. Now, I would say not a lavish lifestyle to say anything, but what it's going to do is it's going to suck some $25 million out of our economy. And that's what happened at the end of 2013. Now, over the next 6 months, you're going to see about 3,600 people each and every week losing these extended unemployment insurance benefits, and that's going to pull more money out of our economy, and yes, it's going to make the unemployment crisis that much worse. So I say right now we need to be immediately moving to get these extensions done. We need to immediately be moving on a jobs plan and so much more, which is why we've asked Maurice Emsellin. He's the director of the Access and Opportunity Program at the National Employment Law Project. Maurice, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this as an absolute no-brainer for the people who tell me that they're business-friendly to be pulling some $25 million out of the economy here just in Pennsylvania seems to me to be very, very short-sighted.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's the latest jobs report, I think, reinforces that. You know, we have very limited job creation, and there's one job available for every three unemployed workers. So there's still a severe jobs crisis, which is why we have this situation of record rates of people who are unemployed for prolonged periods of time. There's so much stiff competition for jobs. You pull the plug on this program of extended unemployment benefits, and you're also pulling large sums of cash out of the national economy, but especially those communities hardest hit by unemployment. So, you know, in Pennsylvania, actually for the whole year last year, the federally funded benefits pumped almost $1.6 billion into the Pennsylvania economy.
Wow.
And that doesn't count.
That's just the extended part, right?
That's just the federal portion of the benefits, not the base 26 weeks of state benefits. This is the federal portion of the benefits, which is a maximum nationally of 47 weeks. But anyway, that's a huge sum of money. That doesn't count what we call the economic multiplier. When unemployment benefits are circulating in the economy, it produces lots of economic activity in addition to the $1.6 billion in direct funding circulating in the economy. So yes, to answer your question, it has a huge impact on the economy, especially those communities hardest hit by unemployment.
You use the word multiplier, and I've had a couple of my fake news and Fox listeners ask me where this multiplier thing comes from, because evidently what Fox is saying is there's no such thing as this multiplier, because they keep throwing out this view that, well, are you saying that we can have everybody sit home and the government give them money and it would grow jobs? I'm curious the multiplier effect and your comment on the on that position.
Yeah, I mean it's just a basic concept, economic concept, and in the case of unemployment benefits, it's been studied for decades, and there are multiple studies that show huge volumes of reports that document how much every dollar in unemployment benefits produces in economic growth, and that's what the studies say. The studies say that $1 in unemployment benefits produces $1.50 to $2 in economic growth. So it can be almost two times the value of the benefit. And that ends up also producing jobs. So, and again, these are official studies. The Congressional Budget Office on down has documented this. If you look, the Congressional Budget Office said that as a result of that multiplier effect, that the benefits will produce 240,000 jobs. That's about 15,000 jobs in Pennsylvania. And that's because of all the economic activity generated by the fact that, you know, every cent of these dollars are spent on basic goods and services.
So you give someone who's unemployed a couple of bucks to help them get through the month, get through until they find another job, buying sugar and shoes, paying rent, doing whatever. That dollar goes into the local economy and it bangs around. It's reverberated.
Exactly.
And it's used to buy the next set of goods and to hire the next set of people, which eventually, hopefully, will be the folks that are unemployed.
Exactly.
Now, I'm looking at this, and, you know, I know a bunch of people who have been unemployed over the last couple of years, and some of them who have been quite long unemployed. In my working lifetime, this time that we're living through right now is the worst for long-term unemployed people, because the length of unemployment seems to be considerably longer than it's been in the past. Do you have any studies or anything that show that? Because, you know, you say it, and, well, people don't seem to want to understand, because they seem to be okay.
Well, empirically, it's a fact that we have never had this many people unemployed for such prolonged periods of time, going back to when the data were first collected in the 1940s. So you have, right now, you have about 4 million people who have been actively looking for work, and they're still unemployed after looking for work for more than 6 months. And that's about 4 out of 10 unemployed of the unemployed, 4 out of 10 of the unemployed workforce. So, you know, that's almost twice the percent of long-term unemployed than we've ever had, going all the way back to the 40s. And we've never cut off benefits, federal extended benefits, when we've been in this situation of extremely high levels of long-term unemployment. And again, you know, this goes back to how severe this recession was. It was a uniquely severe recession and you have large numbers of people who were laid off, unemployed, and limited job growth. So you have this huge reservoir of people who are unemployed and very limited number of jobs that they're competing for, and that produces this perfect storm of long-term unemployment.
Well, here's the thing I've got for you then, because, you know, I think a lot of people forget just how bad 2008 really was and really how bad it would have been had we not had unemployment insurance, had we not had food stamps and a lot of the elasticity programs that were in place to make sure that we never had that hard down that our senator here in Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, wanted, called for, and advocated for, that we would never have that collapse to the bottom again. And I think those programs did exactly what they were supposed to do.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. There's some, you know, just a, you know, one example, in addition to supporting the economy, which we've talked about, the benefits also go a long way to prevent severe economic hardship. So the benefits helped lift almost 4.5 million people out of poverty in 2012 alone, and that included over 500,000 children. So, I mean, you think about the consequence of that, the long-term consequences of that, what it means when a family doesn't have a job, doesn't have any income to support themselves, they end up in poverty, and, you know, that holds them back, them and their children back, from gainful employment, but also all sorts of other, you know, really, you know, positive social benefits can be for their lifetime, certainly for years and decades.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I can't send my kid to college because I lost my job and I don't have any income, you know, coming my way, the kid has to work, can't go to school, that has lasting impact on generations.
Yeah, multi-generational. And to me, education, you know, we've been seeing across the country cuts to education budgets. You know, here in this state, you know, $1 billion each of the last 3 years has been taken from our kids' future. And it just seems to me, again, the same thing that we're not passing this extension. Very tip of the nose, very short-term thinking, and no real visionary leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, it's intransigent. It's the politics that, unfortunately, you know, transcend this unemployment benefit situation. You know, we're dealing with it in lots of other areas too. But I mean, I don't think you can get. It's hard to come up with an example that's as compelling, as clear cut as the unemployment benefit situation.
Right.
You know, nobody's going to dispute. Most, with some rare exceptions, most folks are not going to dispute that these are people who worked hard and did everything they need to do and are still looking hard for work, but they need the extra help to get by.
Yeah, see, I gotta disagree with you on that. We've got a governor, and I don't mean to cut you off, but we've got a governor in this state that's running. When he was running for office, he was saying people were lazy and stupid,
yeah,
that there were jobs out there, and now he's running around saying that they can't pass a drug test.
Right.
I see that there's a political move in this country to demonize the folks who are struggling, to demonize the poor, to demonize the unemployed, to demonize the less fortunate, and I think it's criminal.
Right. No, I don't disagree with you there, that there are folks who, for political purposes, for whatever reason, it seems to work for them to demonize the unemployed, and I agree with you. Rand Paul had some, you know, some comments that were very public about how unemployment benefits are a disservice to unemployed workers, but he ended up backtracking from those comments when folks in Congress took a lot of heat for not reauthorizing the program. When that, over the holiday break, when they left town, there was a ton of press, a ton of calls, and a lot of legislators who before were kind of on that bandwagon were backing off some. So, I mean, it's still a mystery to me how that, you know, that tactic, that political conclusion really, you know, really makes sense, you know, that there really is value to them politically in taking that position. But, yeah, we're no stranger to that. We've seen benefits be cut severely in a number of states way, way back because of Tea Party folks and others who have really jumped on that issue.
Now, we've got here in the state of Pennsylvania, we've frozen our benefits for the next decade, which, again, another one of these these, what they say is, and I don't even know, remember the justification, that they were too generous. I remember them, that being thrown around an awful lot. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Maurice Elmsom. He's director of the Access and Opportunity Program at the National Employment Law Project. You know, one of the things that you know, I just saw this Quinnipiac poll that said that a majority of voters in the country, about 58% of all registered voters, said that they favored a three-month extension. And when you look at the numbers, you know, 83% of Democrats were in favor of it. But surprisingly, and I shouldn't say surprisingly, 54% of self-identified Republicans, you know, they were seemed to be in favor of it.
We released a poll a couple of weeks back with the same conclusion. Another interesting fact from our poll was the percent of folks who felt strongly that that Congress should reauthorize the program was 2-1 in favor of the extension as opposed to against the extension. So, I mean, our sense is that because as the contrary to what some people believe, given you know how much that a period of time has now elapsed since the recession officially ended, you would think that a lot of people are walking around thinking, well, we don't need these benefits anymore. But in fact, it's the opposite, that so many people have come to know family and friends and others who are really hurting as a result of that experience. They, too, are now clear that these benefits are really necessary and that they need to continue until we get to a point where we don't have this crisis of long-term unemployment.
And we move back to a full employment policy, which I want to ask you about in a minute. But, you know, I look at this and I look at these numbers. When 58% of the country is saying, do this, why is it that our Congress seems to be blocking it? Why is it that, you know, if it's supposed to be the house of the people and they do the will of the people, this seems fairly clear to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. But, you know, you have Congress is, it's in this place historically where they're having, there's such, the Tea Party and others, it's just changed the politics dramatically, and it's made it very difficult to come to conclusion and agreement, even on issues that seem very clear cut to most people. You know, on this issue in particular, again, you know, I think the Republican leadership in the House primarily, that objected to reauthorizing the program before they left town over the holidays. You know, I think that what it comes down to is they need to hear from their constituents, and that's happening in a big way, that, you know, that their reality is very different. And that's what politics comes down to. Yep. And that's what we're trying to make happen. And, you know, a lot of people are working hard to reauthorize this program and put the faces of the unemployed out front there to communicate the need to keep the program going. And hopefully that's what's going to turn it around.
Yeah, I'm with you. You've got to contact your legislator early and often. Make sure they know who you are and your name and your position. Last line of question I've got for you, Maurice. You know, because for me, you know, it's great, fine. We need to extend the unemployment benefits. But, you know, most of the people that I know who are on unemployment, in fact, every person that I've ever known who's been on unemployment, and that's just my personal survey, if you will, they've always wanted a job. They've always wanted to go back to work. So isn't the answer to all of this looking at pursuing full employment policies, and if the private sector can't or won't create jobs, isn't it the purview of the public sector to say, we're going to be the employer of last resort so that we get people the dignity of work and the dignity of making their own way?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. You know, there need to be very aggressive job creation policies. We've advocated for them. And also, you know, just to make an obvious point, and you mentioned it before, that Congress and others need to stop doing cutting programs, cutting budgets that end up laying off large numbers of workers, like public sector workers in particular.
You mean like teachers here in Pennsylvania, where our governor cut $1 billion each year of the last 3 years from the education budget, and we've lost 20,000 education professionals?
Exactly. I mean, the public sector's taken a huge hit, and meanwhile, there's the desperate need for teachers, for infrastructure spending and all that, and instead we're seeing a lot of the funding, you know, severely restricted. So, yeah, we agree. And there are proven strategies for creating jobs. There have been, you know, model programs that were funded after, as a result of the Recovery Act, but the funding has dried up. There's no shortage of ideas for how to create jobs for significant numbers of people. And
we just don't have the political will.
But we need the political will to get it done. Right?
Yeah. Insane to me. Maurice, great talking to you. Appreciate the time. Maurice Emslem, Director of the Access and Opportunity Program at the National Employment Law Project. Thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Can I just leave with one phone number for folks to call that makes it a lot easier to get through to your legislators? It's 877-267-2485. That's a number that will patch your callers in directly to their legislators to support the extension.
Can you hit that one more time?
877-267-2485.
And we will make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Maurice, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I had this pledge of allegiance memorized by the age of 6 and recited it countless numbers of times as a student and young man. And I continue to find appropriate places to recite the pledge still today. But as so often the case, I eventually found out that it wasn't always like this. When America entered the last decade of the 1800s, our Pledge of Allegiance did not exist. Mr. Daniel Sharp Ford, the owner of Youth's Companion magazine, and his marketer, James Upham, are both credited with developing the idea of adopting a Pledge of Allegiance in 1892 to help close the remaining wounds of the Civil War. But join us again to meet the author. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Perhaps you thought the political world was finally safe from the dynamic duo of Ford and Raydell. But no, here they come, rushing back into the limelight. Rob Ford, the explosive mayor of Toronto, became a global punchline last fall when a video showed his honor smoking crack cocaine. Then came little blow-ups involving sexual harassment, a murder threat, knocking down a city councilwoman, and drunken rages. Yet, on January 2nd, Rob was back, filing for re-election and blurting out that my record speaks for itself. Well, he's right about that. Even less charming is Trey Raydell, a first-term Congress critter from Fort Myers, Florida. His chief accomplishment in Washington was getting arrested last October for trying to buy cocaine from an undercover cop. But rather than humbly stepping down, or even quieting down, Trey called a December press conference to announce that he's healed. Having completed a 28-day treatment program for addiction, though apparently not for narcissism, the former TV anchorman declared himself fit to return to what I do, what you sent me to do in Washington. Presumably, that does not include scuttling around back alleys seeking drugs and drink. Raydell said that, thanks to God and family, he's a changed man. For one thing, while he still insists that poor families should be subjected to drug tests in order to get food stamps, he has slightly amended that Dickensian stance. I think members of Congress should be tested as well, he said with a straight face. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Raydell wants poor people's food stamps automatically taken away if they're caught using drugs. But a lawmaker who gets nabbed can keep drawing his $170,000 a year government salary. Still, that doesn't make Raydell a hypocrite, because, as Stephen Colbert points out, lawmakers don't get food stamps.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, to help build a strong middle class, to help educate our kids, and to make our lives better than all the programs of government combined.
It all depends on who
Who's in the definition of our? That's the important part there. We'll come back to the Rick Smith Show. Today, back in 1874, the original Tompkins Square riot occurred as unemployed workers demonstrated in New York's Tompkins Square Park, saying, hey, you know what? We'd like jobs. Oh, yeah, maybe some help feeding our family. Now you had a detachment of mounted police who charged the crowd. You know, the horses going, running over people. The police beat men, women, and children with their billy clubs. And, of course, the commissioner of the police department there in New York, a guy named Abram Dury, he said, it was the most glorious sight I ever saw. Those would be the Pinkertons of the day. Those would be the hired thugs. And the sad thing is, you go back through our history, and there's tons of moments like this where the masses have said, hey, we're creating wealth for the very, very few, and the rest of us, well, we're getting nothing. And I've been saying for years what we need the next mass demonstration, Tompkins Square, Coxey's Army, the Bonus Army. We need the next wave of unemployed. And I said, you know, after Christmas, when the benefits went away for 1.3 million people in this country, what would it be like if those 1.3 million people converged on Washington, D.C., or the folks who are near unemployed, saying, hey, you know what? We want trade policies that are going to benefit us. Hello? Not thrilled with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Not thrilled with what's being rammed down our throats. And these trade deals that have done nothing but kill jobs, no more. End them. And, you know, I got to be honest. This is one of those, you know, I had a lunch with a couple of folks I haven't seen in quite some time. And, you know, immediately it turns to all three of us voted for Obama both times. And just to put that on the table. And I said, you know, how do you voted for him? How do you feel about it? And, you know, we went back and forth saying, you know, these are some things I thought he's done well, some things I thought could have done better. All with the caveat of, you know, none of us really know what the pressures are. But I remember going back and saying, you know what? One of the main reasons I voted for Obama the first time, and look, that was the very first time I ever voted for a president. Now, I've voted in presidential elections in the past, and it was generally always against someone. The ideology of Mitt Romney, for instance, you got to vote against that. The ideology of George W. Bush, you got to vote against that. You know, especially on worker issues, just toxic, top to bottom. And I said, you know, I really thought, you know, in some of the 2008 discussions that the president had, we'd be looking at NAFTA, not renegotiating new, bigger NAFTA trade deals, and especially not doing it under the cloak of darkness. And this is what's really got me in this, because, you know, I'm a lot of the people who are pushing this, you know, you have some respect for, with the exception of Max Baucus. But you have some respect for some of the folks. And I don't know whether it's just it's what corporate America is pushing. The only way you're ever going to get elected in this country is you get behind these deals to make the moneyed interests happy. I'm not sure if that's it or if it's just, you know, what we learned in the Koch brother approved economics courses through our university system. I'm not quite sure, because I remembered, you know, hey, free trade's great. And look, I'm not against the idea of trade. I'm against what we have done in the name of free trade. I don't know that a rational human being can look at our trade deals and go, oh yeah, that's good for the country. Now, there are some you could look at and say, well, you know, it depends on who you're talking about. Are you talking about agribusiness? Are you talking about Wall Street? Are you talking about these huge international, these global investors? Then, yeah, those folks have fared very well. Are you talking about people with drug patents? Yeah, they're going to do wildly well. Are you talking about, you know, construction workers. You got to talk about factory workers. Well, not so well. And I guess like anything, there are winners and losers. And for me, you got to balance, you know, who the winners and losers are. The sad reality is, though, the people who work for a living in this country, they're always the losers in this, aren't they? And then when you throw this out there, this trade agreement to me is, from a messaging standpoint for employers, is a boon. Because they're going to be able to go to their employees and go, well, you know, you might want a raise, but you're not going to get one. And if you demand one, we're going to Vietnam, or we're going to Burundi, or we're going somewhere else in the Pacific Rim that we have a free trade agreement with now. I mean, the argument's already there. I mean, they're always saying, we're going to go to China, or we're going to go somewhere else. It's a little more cumbersome now. Still very possible, thanks to our Chamber of Commerce, who make sure that they grease the palms, and they've got I forget how they put it in one of their seminars, we grease the pipeline. I think that was the exact phraseology, that they've greased the pipeline to be able to export jobs from here in the U.S., to places around the world, especially into China, thanks to our Chamber of Commerce. So as you look at this, you know, these trade deals, I remember sitting no more than, I would say, 25 feet from the president, who was then candidate, and said, you can trust me. No, I'm not going to vote for Colombia. I'm not going to vote for these trade deals. And what happened? We got the trade deals. Why? Because that's what Wall Street wanted. Now, look, as I added my caveat to my lunch companions, I said, look, we don't know what the very well-to-do have told him. I said, imagine walking into a room with people much more powerful than the president. And those are the people who control the keys to our economy. Imagine the CEO of General Electric, and imagine the Koch brothers, and imagine these huge hedge fund managers who say, you know what, we'll tank the economy tomorrow. You think your job numbers are bad now? Wait. And I gotta wonder if that conversation has ever happened. I can't imagine that it hasn't. Because we have given these corporate titans too much power. We have given the wealth class in this country way too much power, because we've given them way too much wealth. And I go, oh, yeah, I know, but Rick, I'm going to be one of them someday. No, you're not. No, you're not. This is why we need sane, rational tax code. This is why we need some rational thought in the distribution of wealth in this country. Just a thought. And it's one that we had better start coming around to, and rather quickly. Got to take a quick break. When we come back, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan is launching a new campaign today at the Detroit Auto Show called Labor Rights Are Civil Rights. Nissan workers are joining clergy, the Mississippi NAACP, elected officials, civil rights activists, and students to launch this new campaign aimed at making people aware of the struggle to organize the Canton, Mississippi auto plant. Workers there are attempting to join the United Auto Workers as they push Nissan to agree to a fair union election free of intimidation and threats from the employer. Even as Mississippi workers launch their labor rights or civil rights campaign in Detroit, North Carolina's Moral Monday movement is spreading through the South. After drawing thousands of protesters and inspiring the arrests of more than 900 people in civil disobedience protest actions, Georgia will see its first Moral Monday at the state capitol there. The Georgia NAACP is leading that protest, but the Reverend Dr. William Barber of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement will be at the Georgia protest today. In South Carolina, progressive protesters will greet the state's legislature as it convenes Tuesday for a Moral Monday-style protest billed as Truthful Tuesday. These protests challenge the extreme right-wing agendas of Republican-dominated state governments in the South. The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO has a message for U.S. Congressman Ron Kind. Knock off the support for trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because they are no good for workers or for farmers. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
We have no evidence, and he's presented none, nor has anyone else, that any of these trade agreements do any good for the workers. U.S. Dairy Farm farmers are going to lose over $20 billion in 10 years. And everyone knows Wisconsin's a pretty big dairy state.
The Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO Central Labor Council has sent Congressman Ron Kind a copy of Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown's book, Myths of Free Trade, Why American Trade Policy Has Failed, in an effort to enlighten the congressman about trade policy. Global labor organizations are protesting the gunning down of striking Cambodian garment workers January 3rd. The workers were killed by Cambodian military using AK-47 assault rifles. The government has banned demonstrations and is using the military to control the streets. The violence ended the strike. Industrial, Uni Global Union, the International Trade Union Confederation, the Cambodia Labor Confederation, and Workers United are all demanding that the Cambodian government stop the violence, restore freedom of association and assembly, release the detained workers and drop any charges against them, and resume negotiations for an increase in the minimum wage. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Labor Federation is deeply disappointed in the U.S. State Department for allowing Indian consular officer Devyani Kobragadi to escape visa fraud charges through diplomatic immunity. The charges came after a domestic worker fled working conditions that approached human trafficking, according to Trumka. Trumka says the indictment against the Indian diplomat was a positive step in the movement to uphold the rights of domestic workers, and Trumka says the American labor movement will continue to stand by Sangeeta Richard and the domestic workers' family as they adjust to life in the U.S.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So it was today, back in 1924, that U.S. District Judge G.W. McClintock was so concerned, because at the time they were debating whether we should have kids, you know, working in the mines and in the mills and, 10, 12, 15-hour days and dying on the job. They were actually debating that. Well, it's good for those kids, right? Well, McClintock, he said he was worried. Well, what will these children do? What mischief will these kids get into if they're not working and producing and of course making money for the family? And then there is that conservative world thought that, you know, they got little hands. They can do a lot of intricate work. So we should put them to work. Kind of like Newt Gingrich said, cleaning the bathrooms, fire those union janitors and get those kindergartens in there with their toothbrushes to scrub the commodes. That's what we should be doing. It doesn't seem to change. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, how are we today?
Hey, you doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. What do you think? We should have kids cleaning the toilets, right? Little toothbrushes. They got little hands. Can get behind the in the little spaces.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a long way off from ever having kids. But if I ever do, that would be probably the main reason why I would have them.
All right. Okay. So you never have to clean again. There you go.
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure that's what you do. Like, you know, you use child labor, right, for your kids?
Yeah, they've got chores, but, you know, I'm not sending them a mile underground into the mines to breathe methane and coal dust. I'm not sending my daughters into the looms to breathe the dust from the thread fibers spitting up blood at age 12 and 13. No, I'm not going that far.
Well, you're a softie.
I guess so. Anyway, I guess around the world, things are going wonderfully. Everything's wonderful. I know in West Virginia, they have said that the water is wonderful now. You can have some freedom water now. So what? It glows a little bit. It's a toxic green sludge, but it's good for you now. In fact, the woman who was the spokesperson for the company said she brushed her teeth and didn't get sick, so she doesn't know what the big deal is.
There we go. You know, this, is one of the bigger disasters that we've seen in quite some time. But it looks like, according to the state government at least, the contamination levels are reaching a place that could at least be considered to be somewhat normal.
Do you know what you just said? The contamination levels are normal.
Exactly. I understand exactly how absurd the smell is. But it looks like, they are starting to allegedly use their water again in stages, which is never a good thing that you want to hear. Previously people have been told to withhold from drinking it as well as bathing following this chemical runoff. And it really just looks like this was something that was created from a huge disregard for any safeguards. It looks like the site hasn't been inspected in over 20 years. And it really is just a terrifying turn of events.
And nor should it have been inspected in 20 years. Because those onerous job-killing EPA regulations, they wouldn't have stopped this.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't even had a chance to stop it.
No, exactly. You know, I mean, it's West Virginia. They're not the you know, the most government-loving people. So I'm not surprised that this happened, I guess.
And, you know, the thing that got me is that they evidently, since they're a storage facility, they were exempt from many of the EPA regulations anyway, as well.
No, it's certainly true. And, you know, it doesn't look like this is anything that's going to end very well. There are, of course, some huge questions that are going on right now over how exactly this may have happened. It looks like, you know, there have been a number of people involved who may have been a little bit less than up and coming, including Carl Lemley Kennedy, the second, who pleaded guilty in 87 for selling between 10 and 12 ounces of campaign cocaine. And it really just boggles the mind why this is going on.
Yeah. You know what gets me, though, is the day that it happened. In Congress, the House Republicans passed the Reducing Excessive Deadline Obligation Act, which evidently changed the Superfund laws. It put amendments into the Solid Waste Disposal Act and the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. So it removes requirements that the EPA would have to periodically update and review waste disposal places. And I guess maybe even places like this. I just found it to be quite ironic that on the very day that this happened, the Republicans were making the regulations even lax, even more lax, and taking away the penalties at even a greater amount.
No, it's very true. I mean, this is one of those things that you can't really make up, just the timing of it and how this really just speaks about the need for at least some kind of normal regulatory safeguards. And it looks like that was something that was not respected in this case.
So what I'm looking for is I'm looking for that crafty entrepreneur from West Virginia to come up with a good bottle of Freedom Water. I mean, because it is, after all, Freedom Industries that poured their sludge or whatever it was into American Waters water. So, you know, because nothing says freedom like glowing green toxic sludge water.
No, I mean, we're Americans. We enjoy taking risks. And, you know, if that includes, sludgy, toxic drinking water, then so be it, I guess.
I guess nothing says freedom like violent, violent vomiting that you can't stop.
There we go.
There you go. Okay, let's move on. Chris Christie, some more good news on the Christie front?
Well, this is pretty interesting news for him. It looks like there was a request from a New Jersey Democrat who asked the IG for the Housing and Urban Affairs Department to look into a grant that was placed for ads trying to drum up tourism and economic activity following Hurricane Sandy. And there was a question of whether or not he may have approved the ad or the ad may have been approved since it included the first family of New Jersey in it. And that's something, of course, that has already been raised by a number of conservatives, including some fellow 2016 contenders like Rand Paul, who said, previously that he had some qualms over whether or not this was planned. But we are also hearing some news coming out pretty late in the day from the advertising firm that created this. And they actually said that, believe it or not, Chris Christie was not their first choice for the ad. They had previously, by the time when the ad was approved, they were in fact trying to pitch Bruce Springsteen or Bon Jovi or a number of other New Jersey figures. And I guess unable to get that, they had to sell off a Christie, which is unfortunate since it really makes it look kind of like a shady campaign season ad.
Yeah, I wonder how much Bon Jovi and Bruce wanted.
Yeah, that's a good question. They didn't necessarily say why they did not end up in the ad. I can't necessarily see them asking for very much considering that they've banked their entire marketability on being the Jersey Boys.
I guess it would be like that California ad that has Schwarzenegger and Betty White and a whole bunch of people pitching
exactly.
California.
Right, right.
Interesting. Let's move along. So I guess that before we move along, the bridge thing. Any there? Because now we're hearing maybe the mayor was asked for an endorsement, and maybe, you know, he did say no.
That is a possibility. We're still trying to figure out what level of involvement Christie had. He contended, of course, in his press conference that he was unaware that they were trying to seek his endorsement. There's, some further inquiries that are going on from some reporters who are, kind of speculating that perhaps they were trying to steal the deal with the state senator whose district that included. But nevertheless, it certainly does not seem to be going in Chris Christie's direction. And there is growing doubt over who exactly was involved in this, and it's certainly going to be sort of a much bigger deal when it comes time to appoint new staff members, since it doesn't seem like anybody within Christie's immediate inner circle are really coming out of this looking very good.
Now, have you heard anything of this? The reason maybe may not have been just to punish the mayor of Fort Lee for with the traffic, but to really punish him with some building, some economic development that was supposed to be happening. Because you know when you listen to it on its face that they closed the lanes just for that one day to cause the mayor headaches for that one day, that sounds kind of petty and bush league and really just stupid. But when you throw it into a larger context that by having this massive traffic choke and doing it occasionally so that economic development maybe would go somewhere else off of 95 to somewhere else in Jersey, that may, I don't know, may sound a lot more plausible than we just were going after this one guy for this one day.
No, it certainly does. And if that is the case, then their initial claims that this was a traffic study certainly seems to hold up to better scrutiny. But again, it's too late to tell. There's going to be a long series of investigations that are going to be performed over this, and it looks like it may be quite some time before we get some answers.
Oh, fun. And the Supreme Court, looking at the NLRB appointments, is this kind of deciding when and if the Senate can call a recess, and who decides if the Senate's in recess?
Exactly. This is for the National Labor Relations Board. This was a 2012 decision wherein the White House decided during a pro forma session of the Senate to pass these nominees who were not necessarily controversial by any stretch of the imagination, but were nevertheless being held up by, these filibuster-happy Republicans. And it looks like today in the Supreme Court, all of the justices had some very strong questions over whether or not the administration was overstepping their constitutional boundaries, including Alina Kagan, who, raised this issue up as well. So it looks like it's bad news for the president. We're not going to get a final word on this for quite some time. But the White House today did contend that they did have the authority to move forward with this decision.
So the question then for me that I have then is, all of the recess appointments going back to, to Reagan and beyond that, how far do we untangle this? If recess appointments are not... they're not constitutional. How many bad decisions have come out of their use in the past, and do we get to untangle any of that?
That certainly is a good question. This is not a tactic that was entirely new to the Obama presidency. But, of course, everything that Obama has done that has been used by previous presidents has suddenly become verboten because that's just the way that Republicans play ball.
There you go. All right. Well, big fun there. Also, I saw some interesting healthcare Obamacare numbers. What, some 9 million more people have signed up here recently?
Yes, they have. But it turns out that the majority of people who signed up at around 42% or whatnot are actually older than the demographics that they are aiming for. These are people who are in their 40s. And, of course, in order for the exchanges to work, we need to see a situation where more young people are signing up, which has been one of the major goals for the administration. It's something that the president is going to be directly addressing tomorrow with a roundtable meeting with young people. The White House says, we're the ones who disclose these numbers, but they have nevertheless claimed that there's no need to panic quite yet, saying that considering how, young people are and considering that they don't necessarily believe that they need insurance at this point in their lives, they expect them to sign up en masse closer to the March 31st deadline. So that's where it stands there.
Either that or they've been told that it's impossible to get through the website, and they're waiting until the website is up and running before they waste their time on it.
Yeah, that's another thing. So, of course, been one of the older arguments and one of the older fears that perhaps the initial botched website rollout was sort of poison in the water, since that was caught on by quite a few people, including, kind of pop culture entities like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who sort of made a mockery of it and may have discouraged quite a few young people against signing up.
Yeah, because I look at it, and most of the people that I think are really worried about being uninsured are going to be people in my age bracket who are looking down the road, seeing people a couple of years ahead of them having all these health problems, and going, well, I haven't had health insurance maybe for a couple months, maybe a couple of years, I better get something. I mean, when I was 18, 20, wasn't something I thought about.
No, certainly true. You know, I know a lot of people who are, you know, certainly eligible now and are, you know, in pretty bad situations with low-paying jobs that don't necessarily supply the best benefits. And they haven't quite yet caught on to this, and it looks like, you know, they really will probably come around once they need to.
Yeah, once the penalty phase goes in. And when does that kick in?
That is March 31st.
So we're around the corner. We'll, when the IRS is going to take over the world.
Exactly.
All right, Justin. Always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Hey, you too.
So, Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Perhaps you thought the political world was finally safe from the dynamic duo of Ford and Raydell. But no, here they come, rushing back into the limelight. Rob Ford, the explosive mayor of Toronto, became a global punchline last fall when a video showed his honor smoking crack cocaine. Then came little blow-ups involving sexual harassment, a murder threat, knocking down a city councilwoman, and drunken rages. Yet, on January 2nd, Rob was back, filing for re-election and blurting out that my record speaks for itself. Well, he's right about that. Even less charming is Trey Raydell, a first-term Congress critter from Fort Myers, Florida. His chief accomplishment in Washington was getting arrested last October for trying to buy cocaine from an undercover cop. But rather than humbly stepping down, or even quieting down, Trey called a December press conference to announce that he's healed. Having completed a 28-day treatment program for addiction, though apparently not for narcissism, the former TV anchorman declared himself fit to return to what I do, what you sent me to do in Washington. Presumably, that does not include scuttling around back alleys seeking drugs and drink. Raydell said that, thanks to God and family, he's a changed man. For one thing, while he still insists that poor families should be subjected to drug tests in order to get food stamps, he has slightly amended that Dickensian stance. I think members of Congress should be tested as well, he said with a straight face. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Raydell wants poor people's food stamps automatically taken away if they're caught using drugs. But a lawmaker who gets nabbed can keep drawing his $170,000 a year government salary. Still, that doesn't make Raydell a hypocrite, because, as Stephen Colbert points out, lawmakers don't get food stamps.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Ah, yes, the ring of fire. Oddly enough, Vicky sent me this website that I just think is hysterical. It goes into the United States of Shame. Asks the question, what's your state worst at? And evidently Pennsylvania, worst in the country for arson. Yet we've got more arsonists here in the Commonwealth than anywhere in the country. And there's part of me that goes, you know, could it be the number of volunteer fire departments we have? Uh-oh. Touched on a nerve. I did find some interesting things, though, in the United States of Shame. Those who you know, just want to know where you're going, the worst state in the country for drivers, that would be Massachusetts. The dumbest state, evidently Maine. I'm not making this up. The worst place, the best place for corporations, worst place for people, for corporate taxes would be New Hampshire. Vermont, the worst place in the world for infertility. New York had the worst daily commute. The place I thought that would have had the worst daily commute, California had the worst air pollution. Oregon had the worst homeless population. Washington State, the worst state for bestiality, to get in some of the wonderful things there. Colorado, the worst place for cocaine use. Then you get into some of the really, really bad ones, like Arizona, high on the alcoholism list. New Mexico, high on the antisocial list. Then you get into the South, where you go through the South and you go, really, do we really want to have, like, North Carolina is the worst place in the country for teacher salaries. South Carolina has the most mobile homes. That's something, I guess, to be proud of. Then you get into some of the other states, like Georgia, which is the sickliest state in the country. You go into places like Alabama, the highest stroke rates in the country. Then over to Louisiana. Louisiana has the highest obesity rate. And then you get into other places, in the South there, Arkansas, the highest gonorrhea rate, and so on. It's interesting. Actually, Arkansas had the worst credit rating. Louisiana was the gonorrhea. Mississippi was the obese state, and Alabama was the stroke state. Tennessee, high on the corruption list. You get into West Virginia, the heart attack state. Very nice there. Kentucky, the cancer state. Indiana, the least green state. Illinois, the robbery state. And so on. Ohio was the nerdiest state. Can't quite figure that out. Delaware was the abortion state. Maryland, the AIDS state. And so on. It kind of caught my attention. Then you get into the North Dakota, the ugliest state. I don't know how you rate that. How do you then go, well, you're just absolutely the ugliest state of all. I guess it's better than being the rape state like South Dakota, and so on. I mean, it just is kind of interesting. The one I found that kind of caught my attention, I thought, wow, women are actually pulling their own, is Oklahoma. Evidently, Oklahoma has the most female criminals. Very, very interesting there. Lastly, I wanted to wrap up with a study that was done by this woman, Mary Willingham, of the University of North Carolina. Evidently, she had done some research that showed between somewhere around 8 to 10% of the athletes at the University of North Carolina in their football and basketball programs. Rated somewhere in the third grade reading level. The university didn't agree. They fired her, I guess, saying that they can't comment on the statistics because they've asked for them, haven't gotten them, but it can't possibly be true, even though they funded the study. Now, the woman has gotten death threats, 4 death threats and more than 30 other alarming messages. Because people don't agree that some athletes didn't learn to read or write really in school. And 8 to 10%, I got to be honest, having gone and played some college ball in the past, I don't know. 8 to 10, that seems kind of low. Just saying. But, the other part of this is, why would you send someone a death threat over saying, hey, we've got a problem, maybe we should fix it? Amazing. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Appreciate you being here. Download the podcast there. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. We'd love to hear from you. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the blood.